Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Fucked Up is an uncommonly excellent, ambitious, and prolific punk band based in Toronto, Ontario. Over the past 20 years or so, Fucked Up have written and recorded a truly remarkable discography, won prestigious awards, toured the world, advocated for and elevated their community, and have purposely and charmingly challenged the expectations of fans and critics with every new release and venture. On January 27th, 2023, Merge Records releases One Day, the sixth proper Fucked Up full-length album, whose conceptual conceit is that each musician in the band only had 24 hours to complete their respective parts for guitar arrangements that band leader Mike Halichuk wrote and recorded in the same manner. Over three separate recent conversations, I spoke with bassist Sandy Miranda and drummer and vocalist Jonah Falco, composer, guitarist, lyricist, and vocalist Mike Halichuk, and lyricist and lead singer Damian Abraham, about things like wildlife in London, England, and Toronto, Ontario. creative stipulations and learning in public, grieving lost loved ones and keeping their memories alive, cicadas and nautical notions, gentrification, loving punk gathering spots like Who's Emma in Toronto when we're kids, but later discovering that such places likely displaced others, agoraphobia and dehumanizing technologies, the Turned Out a Punk podcast and the Tragically Hip, treating every fucked up album like it's the last one, upcoming fucked up releases, touring, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you, who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary source of revenue for this show and all the work that goes into it. Thanks for your support at patreon.com/creativecontrol. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and very friendly staff who will happily help you fulfill whatever it is you're looking to order. Say you want to order the new Fucked Up album One Day, or one of their 3 million Zodiac releases, or whatever the hell else they're up to. Well, you just go to blackbird.ca and you type in what you want, and lo and behold, it should be there and you can order it for yourself. Once again, that website, blackbird.ca. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 747 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Sandy Miranda, Jonah Falco, Mike Halichuk, and Damian Abraham from Fucked Up, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Sandy. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you doing? Long time no see.
Yes, long time no see. We can actually see each other using the marvels of technology, and you look like you're comfortable. I like what's going on behind you there. It's lovely.
I've been fixing up my place during COVID.
That's great. Where in the world are you, Sandy?
I'm in downtown Toronto, near Little Italy. I could see the CN Tower from my window. Daily inspiration.
Do they still light that sucker up, like in different colors and stuff sometimes?
Yeah, they do, actually. And there are, I think they do on programs. And so, you know, during Christmas, there's greens and, you know, reds. And during Halloween, there's oranges. It's very inspiring stuff.
Oh, nice. That's great. I'm glad Toronto's putting some money into cheering everyone up. Finally, after years. Yeah. Anyway, it's lovely to see you and hear from you. Also on the line, Jonah, are you there?
Hey, I'm here. How are you, Vish?
I'm well. Thanks for asking. Where in the world are you?
I am in the London borough of Hounslow, and I'm on my boat where I live, and just floating away.
The famous boat. Everyone.
The famous boat. This is the stuff of I think everybody. You'd think that this would be like a more focal point, but I'm very reserved. You know, the floating life, it's one of solitude and interiority, not for broadcast. But here we are talking about it.
Now, the boat seems stable. I expect the thing we're using, I can see both of you. I expect there to be rocking, you know, waves crashing against the boat. Is it generally fairly stable?
Yeah, it's very stable. When you live on the inland waterways, the water's only about waist deep. And they're completely manufactured waterways. They were cut into the landscape by engineers and navvies many years ago, 100 years ago or 150 years ago. So the turbulence is pretty moderate. Even on a windy day, though, the boats rock around. And if a really big boat goes past and they're going too quickly, all that water displacement sends you sort of creaking and the ropes creak and that kind of stuff. But no, it's very calm. It was a clear, sunny day here in the London borough of Hounslow.
Now, so wait a minute. No ocean. The ocean doesn't feed into your waterway at all? Is that what you're getting at?
The ocean does feed into the River Thames, which is about 500 meters to my right.
Right.
But we are on the Grand Union Canal, which is separated from the River Brent by the Brentford Gauging Lock. Yeah. And then that is separated from the River Thames by the Thames Lock. And then the Thames itself, you must travel east like 90 miles or something to get out to the channel. So the ocean is pretty far away.
Okay. All right. Now, Sandy in Toronto, in terms of wildlife, I'm gathering the odd time you see a squirrel, pigeon, probably a coyote. Sometimes now there's more coyotes in Toronto, I hear tell. Is that true?
I actually a coyote did walk past me when I was in Baby Point last year. But my area actually has a lot of skunks.
Oh, yeah, right. The skunks. Okay. Yeah, that's a drag.
Yeah, which is usually no big deal unless I'm walking a dog and then, you know, I need to be careful. Yeah. They're pretty damn cute, though.
I was, my window faces like, we live like pretty close to downtown in Edmonton here. And there's when it got really cold a couple weeks ago and I had my blinds up here in my office, I see the street, giant coyote just walking down the middle of the road. Cause something happened with the rabbits. They got all sick and they died. Mm-hmm. And now the coyotes are hungry and they're attacking, people. So that's not good. Oh. Yeah, they're hungry. They're hungry coyotes. And I didn't expect that when I moved to Edmonton. I was like bears. I expect there to be a bear every once in a while, but not coyotes. Anyway, Jonah, brief wildlife check in there. You're in the water.
We got it all.
What do you got there?
Okay. The most bothersome critter that we encounter is called a coot, which is a sort of waterfowl, and they have webbed feet, and they're mostly flightless birds. They just swim around. I'm pretty sure they can fly, actually, but you don't see them flying. Huh. They make horrible, high-squitched, airy peeping sounds. They nest on everything. They're really aggressive.
Oh.
They are kind of confrontational, but, you know, generally they're small. The moorhen is also a lovely waterfowl. They're much more friendly, and they just scamper around and do their thing in the nearby bushes and in the waterways. We have many different varieties of duck. Some which are very beautiful, some which are pretty run of the mill. There are herons. There are the worst of all is the Canadian goose, which is a complete menace. They are aggressive, form gangs. They attacked me many times last year.
You got attacked by a Canadian goose. Do they know you're, they sense it?
They think
one of our own.
No, they're like, you defected. What's your problem? So they've come for me. And at one point, it was the middle of the night. I was taking out the trash, and this thing squared up to me and started barreling right at me. The next day, I was walking down the pontoon, and I heard this flapping. And the next thing you know, this same goose is flying at me full speed from, you know, 50 meters away or something. And
goose?
Really,
how do you know it's the same goose? They all look exactly alike.
But look, you get a sense of goose personality when you're around these things.
I see.
So among all this other aggression, every night, it didn't happen so much this last year, but the year before, in around March, every night at 4:30 in the morning, about 50 geese would just start honking at each other relentlessly.
Wow.
And you have no idea how loud that is. And I play drums in Fucked Up. I know loud. I'm surrounded by some of the loudest instruments on the damn circuit. And these geese, I feel like I've slept through a Fucked Up set better than I've slept through Goose Rave. So.
Oh my God. Okay. I didn't realize that.
And then we also have foxes.
Oh.
We also have.
Oh yeah.
And they make a really strange noise. And when we've been moored on other parts of the canal, you encounter deer. And deer have a really horrible, horrible sound that they make if they're in distress. And one fell into the water right beside our boat. It sounds exactly like a person screaming
really?
For their life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
it's
really disturbing.
Yeah, like a clumsy deer fall into the water, like an Inspector Clouseau-like situation.
Made Clouseau look like the flying Belendez.
Wow. I'm sorry. I mean, maybe you got to get off the boat. I was just talking about how calm the boat is. And it sounds like a disaster.
Well, it's a real, you know, greyhound station of shitty animals sometimes. Herons, also horrible sound. And then in the park just down the road, there are bulls for some reason.
Bulls?
And, yeah, oxen, bulls, cows, they all just cruise around. And there was a moment over the summer here, there's a huge drought, and all the grass turned, like, brown and crunchy, and it looked really arid. It looked like the Southwest, or it looked like, you know, it looked like something from a cowboy film. And there was, of course, oxen walking around. So
that is bizarre. When I asked this question, I thought you were going to say like goldfish, you know, the odd minnow. I thought we
carp is popular,
but
by the way,
you've got like a farm. It's like a farm, basically. Yeah. That is remarkable. Well, I'm glad I checked in. I didn't know that. I don't know what boat life is like. I was not expecting that. So that's weird. Anyway, speaking of slightly weird things, let's talk about Fucked Up. No offense. This new record is brilliant, by the way. I want to say that right off the top. Oh, it's amazing. I've been texting Mike for whatever that's worth. And every time I drive in the minivan, I have this new record one day blasting. And it's a fun, for what it's worth, a fun record for me to drive around with. I enjoy it. I don't know what that means, but I particularly like, I really like it. It's really striking me in a nice way. Sandy, let's begin with you. I know Jonah, you and Mike began sort of working together in a way on this before anyone else, but I want to go to Sandy first because, I want to know what the process was like for you, to work on a record in this way. And if you can talk about that a little bit, how it came to be. And within that, as you're speaking, if you can think of it, whether or not this process, which I believe is quite unique, differs much from how Fucked Up's been working in the last few years. I don't know if that is clear enough for you, but can you begin just by describing what your role in this record one day has been?
Well, I'm the bass player, supply the bass. Jonah's also, part of the rhythm section, so we kind of liaised quite a bit with the songs.
Yeah.
And for this one, I believe it was February 2020. Is that right, Jonah, that we did this?
That's about right, yeah. Yeah. Because I did mine at the end of – I did my tracks at the end of January 2020.
Mm-hmm. February 20, that's the advent. The advent. It's like a calendar, a pandemic calendar. But that is basically when we started to hear things were going wrong. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. We snuck this one right under the wire.
Yeah. Anyway,
or at least the beginning of it.
Sorry to interrupt you, Sandy. Yeah.
That's okay. But yeah, so it was February 2020, and I remember because I was playing the Bernie Sanders debate, the presidential, it was a primaries debate that was running on my TV, and Mike and Jonah were saying that, the concept for the new album is just to see what we can do in a day, right? 24 hours. So basically spent a lot of time at home, which it's funny because it was pre-COVID, but I guess I was practicing, how to just sort of work on something at home in my space.
Yeah.
So basically, Mike and Jonah were, farting around the studio, getting some ideas down, and pretty much had the songs were formed, basically. So I got the MP3s and just kind of tried to find, my nook where I could in bass and kind of, I mean, in my head, I was thinking, okay, this could be the last Fucked Up record, so I better give her, right? And I had the time constraint, right? So I couldn't go too crazy. And so I just sort of put – I already had the beginnings of a little bit of a studio at my space here in Toronto. And I just purchased Ableton, which I had been kind of playing around with for a few years already.
Yeah.
And just jumped in. Basically head first. And I knew I didn't have much time to play with because, we had the 24 hours limitation, just get it done within 24 hours. So I definitely drank a lot of iced coffee, which good thing. I am really good at making iced coffee. And I was drinking about
confirmed.
Yeah. Honestly, I was drinking about a liter a day.
Wait a minute. So did you work 24 hours to get your parts done in a row?
I tried, but Jonah, can I be should I reveal? It was 24 hours. I couldn't do it 24 straight, so it was 12 and 12, basically.
Yeah, no, that's fine. But okay, so would you take a nap?
Oh, I didn't really, sleep very much. I just was, I'm a coffee addict. I don't know if you know this about me.
No, I didn't.
I just got into the zone. And in fact, I shot a little time lapse of the whole process. I don't know if you saw it. I can show it to you if you want to use it.
Where is that? What's it on Instagram or something?
I don't know. I just sent it to the guys several months ago. By the way, I made this. I believe it's part of the record package. I could send it to you.
But basically,
I recorded the whole thing and it's just me going this really fast. Because it's time lapse, right?
Right, okay.
And, and you can see, I'll play a bit, and then I'll eat pizza, watch some of the debate.
I see. Okay. Now, you are used to, I think, being in Fucked. There's a few things you said there that I want to follow up on real quick. One, your point that this could be the last Fucked Up record. I feel like you've had that feeling a few over the last few records, if I may. I'm just guessing.
And I'm usually wrong about it, too.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that for a moment. Like, why does that keep lurking within you every time you do something? But also, I was going to say, you're used to getting kind of weird, I think, used to getting weird messages about what Fucked Up are going to do. What did you make of the 24-hour, one-day concept as a musician? And did you be like, were you like, why? Why are we doing this? Or were you like, okay, that's fine. That's a concept.
No, you know what? I'm up for whatever, you know, I mean, we've been a band for, it'll be 22 years coming this March and, you know, it keeps things interesting, I guess. But I thought it was cool, you know, but we didn't really know that COVID was gonna, was gonna happen. So that was kind of a bit interesting. Although there were murmurings in the news. But no, I was cool with it. I mean, you know, years ago we would record together in a studio, or we'd be in a practice space together and just throw things together. You know, Mike or Jonah would, you know, take the lead, and I'll try as a bass player just sort of find my groove.
Yeah.
But what I did like about it, like I did like the independent work aspect, because then I could take time if I wanted to without judgment of like trying different things, mm-hmm. right? Because sometimes if you're on this, you know, with people in person, you feel on the spot, and if you don't have something right away, then, you know, it can kind of create some anxiety. But I think I thrive in independent study like this.
Yeah.
And it is a contrast to how things used to be done, but you know, you can't do the same thing forever in the same way forever.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of me did kind of like want also some like immediate feedback with someone, to have a sounding board, to have someone there with you. I really miss that.
Yeah.
But I think it turned out cool. And I think, you know, this is something that we'll continue to do. I mean, especially with Jonah being in England.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have the benefit of being able to be together. And, you know, like I said, you know, been a band for a long time, processes change. And so right now we're in the remote version of Fucked Up, where everyone is separate physically, but we're together virtually.
Yeah.
And I think it's just the future, man.
Yeah. Well, before we go to Jonah on his perspectives, though, can we follow up on this impulse you seem to be having of in the last, I would say, certainly since I started doing this show and you've been on it, you've sort of intimated like this could be it. Even in the biographical information that accompanies this record, Damien says this: I thought this could be the last time I recorded my vocals, like recorded vocals for a Fucked Up record. I mean, that when you started this, there wasn't a pandemic. I think the pandemic adds a layer of, for some of us, appreciating life more, appreciating mm-hmm. what we're doing more, but also starting to think, is this the last time I'm going to go to this pizza place? Is this the last time I'm going to get to go do this trip to or go on tour? So that's kind of floating in the air. Is that mostly what informs your feeling of like a bit of dread or doom that this is it, kind of?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's like the stoic in me, you know, that anything you have can be taken away from you at any moment, or it can end at any moment, and to really appreciate it when you have it. Like, there's part of that. You know, we've been a band for so long, and you know, a band is really just about relationships and how well they work or how well they don't work, or if they work even when they're not working, right? If they're working through the dysfunction. And I just, I've always felt this. It is strange. You pointed that out, because like there was a long time where I thought, well, every year being the band, I thought it was going to be the last one. And here we are, right? Yeah. We're all getting up there, and, you know, things are still going on. But I was wrong every time. But you know what? It doesn't mean I'm all of a sudden gonna, you know, take it for granted and think, oh yeah, you know what? I don't have to really think too hard on this recording because there's always going to be another one. Well, you never know.
That's true.
And especially now with COVID, like we've lost so many people, right? That I find that, you know, so we played a couple shows on Halloween this year, and I was there, and I saw Nick Flanagan there, and he was talking about a friend of his who had passed. And I remember riding my bike home after soundcheck thinking, oh my God, I could die on my bike, like riding home from soundcheck. Like, you know, things could be, like, it can end at any moment. So,
I was looking at the thank yous, on this record, like in the credits, and it's mostly all people who have passed away. I think there is, and when you hear Mike's certain songs like Cicada, really talk about this, like appreciating the people that are gone, but also I was just talking about this with Don Pyle recently, because he put out, I have it, a copy of it right here, just to plug Don's book, Shot in a Mirror. And Don and I were talking about the fact that so many of the people he's photographed have passed away for various reasons. And then that gives the photographs that he's been living with, in some cases for decades, more gravity. He looks at, they become different. The same photo that's been hanging in his studio with two people who are living, once they go, it just changes everything. And when I looked at that list of people that was in the credits for one day, I couldn't help but notice that they were, Jonah, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe they're all people who have left this place.
I think some living people are thanked, but we do acknowledge a lot of the people that we've lost. Yeah. And it's striking when you lose people anyway. And in the, especially Riley and Wade, who passed away, that was sort of also in like the thick of lockdown and isolation and stuff like that. So these are strange times to deal with people passing away, and Dallas and Steve Bennett passing, and Ian Warang, like, all of these things happened sort of like an avalanche, either in the thick of or coming out of whatever version of reality we were experiencing over the past 3 years. So, yeah, I mean, this is true.
I hope to talk to Mike at least about, how that loss has informed this record. Because I do hear it as a record of, I mean, it's confronting a lot of horrible shit, but I also feel the gratitude in there and the longing for people who aren't around. In any case, I want to get back to the process here a little bit. Sandy, thanks for explaining that. Jonah, you get weird. I hesitate to use the word weird, but I sense that Mike has these ideas and concepts, and I know you two work very closely together. From what I understand, he went into the studio and came up with guitar parts, and then were you the first to hear these, Jonah?
I may have been the first to hear these. I was the first to hear about them anyway.
Yeah.
At some point in late 2020, Mike mentioned late 2019, Mike mentioned that he had been going into the studio with our longtime audio engineer, collaborator, Alex Gamble, and been making some music. And usually when Fucked Up is writing material, in the last sort of 4 years anyway, what happens is the music itself gets written in the studio. He and I will go in. He'll come up with a guitar line. I'll try and help develop that line, add some drums to it, or this, that, and the other. And that's kind of been a common practice for how songs have been written and Fucked Up for the past couple of years before COVID and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So when he told me he'd been going into the studio with Alex, I sort of thought nothing of it, although it was the first time that he'd just gone in on his own. So something was already a bit different. Mm-hmm. And shortly thereafter, he explained to me that what he was doing was he had done 3 8-hour sessions totaling 24 hours, and he'd come up with a bunch of songs and arrange them. And the idea was that he was going to pass them along to each band member, kind of like a game of broken telephone or something, to sort or Mad Libs or whatever you want, to kind of complete their parts. And the stipulation was that we weren't allowed to hear it first. So there was this kind of gamified version that I was introduced to. And of course, like, Mike was really excited about the tracks. And when I was in Toronto and I would see him, he would say, I kind of really want to play these songs, but I feel like it should be a surprise. So the trick was that I was only allowed to listen to them on the day I started recording.
Huh.
Because theoretically, that was how he did it too. He went in the studio with zero material and just played the guitar, and out it came, and it got arranged. So I was supposed to do it the same way, like going in with no material, no concept of, no preparation, no preconceptions of what it was going to sound like. I had no idea what it was going to sound like. I did get a sneak preview on a car ride once, and it was, I had no idea what to make of it. It was
just, you just heard the guitar.
One was
just the guitar.
I just heard the guitars. The guitars feature a lot of octave pedal and interlocking parts. I nicknamed it chamber hardcore. So it was kind of like totally new musical experience. And I didn't receive a copy of the tracks or anything like that. And I got a Dropbox link the day before I went up to the studio. I recorded my drum parts in a place called Armley, which is in Leeds in the UK. And me and the engineer opened the sessions together, and it was just piles and piles and piles of guitar loops. And, you know, if you look at a fucked up recording session, it's just tracks upon tracks upon tracks upon tracks upon tracks upon tracks upon tracks. Yeah. Da, da, da. So out come these rainbow colored sessions, and it was a new experience. Now, I was used to writing in the studio. Yeah. I was used to writing extemporaneously and off the cuff and trying to make decisions based on things that I'm hearing instantaneously. But this was like, the nice thing about this is that even though it was an isolated experience for everybody, we all kind of experienced it in the same way for the first time when we were trying to commit something to permanence.
Do you think that the stipulation that Mike, decreed, do you think he was trying to simulate a jam-oriented atmosphere?
No, not at all. I think this was about an idea. Every fucked up record has a central idea, a central theme. And sometimes that theme or idea is contained in the lyric writing. And other times the theme or the idea is contained in the music. And the music has gotten way more diverse over the years. And it's harder and harder to think this is what this record was about. You know, David Comes to Life, I think, was probably the last record that had a real definitive. And Glass Boys too, like those two records had a sound, they had an approach. Everything after that has been like just about doing whatever musical idea sort of comes out. So I think this was just about the idea. The idea was to make a record in 24 hours that couldn't be prepared for, that couldn't have any of our personal expectations projected on it because we didn't have time to do so. You know?
Yeah, no, sorry. When the 24-hour thing, I get. I understand that concept. Sandy, what I was getting at, and I don't know if you can appreciate where I'm coming from with it, but to suggest that you can't hear it or spend too much time with it before you come up with parts for it suggests that Mike is like, play impulsively. Play like we're in the room and I'm playing this for you, and you're going to kind of come up with your parts, because that's sometimes what happens in a band. Someone comes up with a guitar part or a lead idea, and then they say, here's what I have, and then everyone tries to play along with it until you end up with like, yeah, this feels like it's this feels ready, this feels good. So Sandy, when I that part of the stipulation, did you feel like Mike was like, play like what instinctually comes to you? You have this time constraint, yes. But also, I'm not going to let you hear, you're not going to be able to spend too much time with it. That's what I'm getting at, where he's trying to simulate the notion of like, it's me in the room playing you my, what I think the arrangement is. What do you want to do with it? Does that make sense to you, Sandy?
Yeah. Yeah. In a way, I guess it is similar to being in the, it's been so many years since we've actually written all together or have been together during formation.
Yeah.
I guess David Comes to Life would be the last time that that's how it was sort of done. But I have to say, like, you know, February 2020 feels like so long ago that it's hard to actually go back and think about my mindset then.
Yeah.
But in a way, like, you know, hearing it come, you know, out of your mouth, it sort of is, I guess, similar to, you know, working to like when we're together in this space, but I don't know.
I'm not sure that was intentional. If it is, then it is. Yeah. But I don't think it was intentional.
The 24-hour thing I get. But what I'm getting at, Jonah, and I don't mean to cut you off, but like, why else would he say you can't spend time with it? Like more than you like. You know why?
The thing you're correct in saying the idea was to sort of foster some impulse.
Yes.
Here, rather than calculation. But I also think that part of enabling that impulse was very much directly related to the time constraint in order to just get it done.
Right.
So
fair enough.
I think that Fucked Up had been working on stuff for a long time and nothing was getting over the line. And I think that the 24-hour thing, how this is relative to impulse and doing things, is like, okay, you can't listen to it, you can't practice and decide when you're ready, you just have to get it done in 24 hours. And I think this was kind of about efficiency more than it was about, you know, fostering a jam-like relationship. And I also think that the whole remote aspect, even though it's pre-COVID, of course, is in response to the fact that, like, we didn't jam together as much anymore or at all. And, of course, I'm have moved country and XYZ. So it's harder for us to get together. So this was a way to finalize something in stages almost instantaneously. And I think that that was, you know, it totally set a new precedent for how we work together, and also is a very unique way to make a record.
Absolutely.
And for me personally, it was challenging because I do have a bit of a perfectionism in me. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, didn't allow for that. I really had to try and stick to the time constraint, because honestly, I could be working on something forever and it could never be good enough, and it holds me back.
Yeah.
So I think Mike and John are really good at just keep moving forward, keep going. Don't worry if it's not, you know, it's not like perfect, you know, perfection doesn't exist, and just keep forward. Whereas like if Fucked Up was just me, I don't know what my O would be like, because it just wouldn't be good enough. I'm just so hypercritical of everything I do that, you know, the guys help kind of unlock that aspect. Well, not unlock, but like just help me push past that, because I definitely do have an issue with knowing when something is done.
Yep, fair enough.
You know, like we've had some songs in the past, like I can't remember which ones, but you know, a song will come out at a practice and be done in like 10 minutes, and Mike will be like, all right, that's done, let's move on to the next, and I'd be like, what? Like, that's done? But you know, it was done, and sometimes you need to just know when it's done and just move on.
I mean, surely though, Sandy, that a song for you as a player can evolve in a live setting, right? Like if you were like,
oh yeah, over time.
Yeah, yeah. Like I didn't really like the way I play. All right, I play better now.
Oh, dude, I did. Are you kidding me? In 5 years, I'll be playing completely different lines on these songs, you know, because I get more comfortable. And sometimes you listen back to an old recording and just kind of cringe. Like, I don't know, Jonah, like when you listen to Hidden World, like you can hear all the imperfections.
I think I've had this chat with every member of Fucked Up about how kind of cringy it is to listen to those old records, and how we play too fast and the recordings are weird sounding, and the playing is inept and totally unrefined, but that's just is what it is, right? And I think the same, Sandy, that's, you put it really well, actually. Like, what you have to know when it's done. And, for those old recordings, that was the best we knew. They were done. And, you know, like there are some great successes of all those really old recordings that I listen to now. And I'm like, I could never do that again because of whatever, how I consider my own skill level, what it's capable of, or what I am doing, you know. And it's the same for every member who's progressed as a player, right?
And like for us, choppy as some of those old recordings are, what's still captured is just the essence of them, right? The essence comes through. You can see past, you know, some of the imperfections or rough areas. As long as you can kind of get the general essence, then you're good. And in a way, this album is about, it just captures the essence of the time, or the essence of what the intent was.
I relate my work in this realm to musicians as well, in that we're all learning in public, which is a bit of a weird thing to do. Like you hear, and we're all documenting all of it. It's not just like, I had a bad show, and that was 15 years ago and it's gone. It's like, you guys make records and you document your progress as people and musicians. And I'm, you know, in this realm or whatever, I'm just constantly capturing flaws.
The learning process.
The learning process. And I think that's something we all have to, get. People used to be like, I couldn't do what you do. I couldn't listen to my voice all the time. Like, isn't that annoying? I'm like, yes, I'm annoying. I get what you're saying. However, I've learned to live with it. Like, I know who I am now, and by editing myself, as you do, Jonah and Sandy, when you're thinking about your parts, you're like, yeah, don't do that. Or that's really good that you know how to do that now, you know? Like, that's just the thing I'm trying to get at there, based on what you guys are talking
about. It's interesting to get stuff wrong in this context where, you know, like I say, we're hearing things for the first time, especially with drums. It's not always clear to me, or my impression of where things go is not necessarily how the song was written. And actually, despite the sort of free-flowing nature of all this, there was an intention with how the song was written. Every songwriter does that. You say, like, this is riff A, this is riff B. in my mind, I hear this. So if I was going to do something completely different, that could derail the song. And I don't think the point of this record was to derail the songwriting process from the point of their origin. I think it was just to do things in a different way that got them done quickly, but got them done with a really kind of heightened focus.
Yeah, fair enough. Sandy, I saw your hand up for a moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think Fucked Up might be the epitome of practicing in public, because if you've seen our first show and second show, you wouldn't think that we'd continue. Like, we were awful. Like, but like maybe like sound wise was pretty rough and, you know, not the greatest, but what carried us forward was just the energy. Like, you don't have to be good from day one. As long as you just put your heart and soul
spirit
and energy into something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really about the spirit, which kind of pushed us forward. And then we got better with their instruments and better with working together. And things just kept happening and we just never stopped.
Well, practicing in public is what bands do.
Yes.
You know, you can rehearse for this moment of spontaneity as much as you want, but like things don't develop until you really road test them. And that's why, you know, good bands are usually on the road all the time.
Yeah.
And they're the energy and the relationship between how people play together. I mean, it's very hard to replicate that in the studio, but what you do replicate in the studio is this interplay between people and how you play with each person's style of playing. Yeah. So this is the nature of being in a band.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And
versus a studio producer that's making beats for Nissan adverts, you know what I mean?
Well, yes, and I think that one of the reasons Fucked Up is so beloved is the spirit of the thing. I think people want to get behind, they appreciate what you're doing and as an entity and in terms of what it says about community building and all those sorts of things. I've talked to Jonah about this kind of stuff before, and I know it gets a little highfalutin, but I do think that that's one of the things that your band resonates with people, because people believe in what you believe in, and that's part of it. It's not just these great records and these great concepts and whatnot. We've covered a lot of ground here, and I appreciate this insight into One Day. One last sort of process-oriented question for you, Sandy, because Jonah experiences Mike's ideas as guitar parts. What do you get in the end to work with in terms of putting your bass on stuff?
Well, I need Jonah's drums in there. Like, you know, I mean, because like, you know, recently actually, or maybe about a month or two ago, Mike sent some of his guitar and there's no drums. And I'm just like, I just need the drums. I need to lock in with them. I need to kind of I kind of take like with the drums and the guitar together that I need the two. I need the two anchors. I can't just run with the guitar because the drums will just change the energy of the song, you know, I want to sort of match and enhance, you know, that energy. So
in a way, Sandy what Sandy's saying is totally true. Like we've both now experienced just raw guitar tracks, and you have to make sense of it in a totally different way. And there's so much happening in these tracks, so much counterpoint and all this, that, and the other. It's hard to find the note center because you don't really understand where.
Yeah.
It's hard to hear where the song is going when you don't have a context of what the rhythm's doing, you know, what the dynamics are supposed to be doing. So it's an interesting blank slate.
Yeah.
So in a way, Sandy, you got like more of the song in a sense. At that stage.
Yeah.
The song was definitely fully formed. Like, I would say that if like to be the drummer in this type of scenario would be quite challenging, because I feel like your options are way more like unlimited, right? Like in terms of like your tempo or like what you're hitting. Like, so, you know, I feel that,
there's a pretty awesome outtake from, one of these One Day tunes. I can't remember exactly which one, but I was really struggling to understand what to do. And in conversations I was having with Mike at the time, he was trying to give me some guidance, because if I played it on completely the wrong beat, then that derails the song and the project. So he was just like, look, this is this. Anyway, but before I had that information, I was trying to experiment and I couldn't come up with something that I felt good enough about. I thought this is too easy and it's not interesting for the song. And there's like a take of, I think it's, I can't remember which song it is now, but it's like a drum and bass style drum beat over the whole song, like 90s drum and bass style, like super fast snares and cymbals. And like, yeah, this is one of those things where, you know, your options are to open it. And so, but what it led to in terms of developing the songs was a happy medium between, I really put myself in my place to a certain extent. And I think this is something that maybe we can all relate to having played on this record, is that like, as a group, when you're playing these parts, people's personalities, naturally, you sort of fight to have your voice heard. Yeah. And like I alluded to this loudness, like that's just the group dynamic. Who can be louder than the other person? Who's getting out of the way because someone else is louder? And in Fucked Up's past recordings, there's a lot of, and it makes these recordings very good, but there's a lot of like competition of how to, you know, this is where all the musical development happens. Yeah. The bass line takes over here. The guitar lead is the focus. All of a sudden there's a drum roll. The vocals are really quick. The vocals are slow. You know, in this, I really feel as though I tried to find my place a lot more and just be on drums and help drive the song rather than try and help myself be a loud voice.
And actually, I had the same problem.
Yeah, there you
I
go.
I remember the first takes of a lot of the songs. I think you like you may have said something like, "Sandy, it sounds like a bass
solo."
a bass sound on every song. It sounded like a bass solo because I'm thinking, "Oh my god, this is our last album. I better give it." And I'm just like, overcomplicating, not even thinking about what it would be like to have to perform that like every night if I can even like maintain it. So, you know, Jonah kind of helped me just, you know, to chill a little bit.
This is the thing. Because we practiced while we existed, and, you know, what was the phrase we came up with before? Practice while you play or something, or play while you practice. Learning as you play, whatever it was.
Yeah.
We
practice in public.
Practice in public.
I said learning and practicing. My thing is learning in public. But yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
But practicing in public and developing who you are as a musician in this is punk music, rock music, whatever. It's not a very coded space.
Yeah.
It's not like you sit down at the drums and you're like, well, I have two bars of snare to play and measure 136. And like, oh, on the bass, I'm supposed to play one note for 45. You know, this is not how this music is made. It's about spontaneity and it's kind of about competition.
Yeah.
And all of our personalities develop that way. And so, and also when given the, like Sandy said, when given the freedom to just do what you want, you think, well, I better showcase all these things I've learned instead what happened though, which is good in the end, it showcased the kind of like a positive musical hierarchy of how these instruments can work together in a new way.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I will tell you that when I first,
and it rocks
when I, well, yes, and it does. It sure, it rocks. If we want to get FM radio about it, it totally rocks. I agree with you on that front. I will say when I first pressed play, I think I might be weird. Kind of threw me for a loop, yeah. and I think I expressed this to Mike at the time, but I love it. It's like one of my favorite songs that you've ever done. Now there are some anomalies, and I will also just really quickly suggest that Mike and Damien as lyricists have really stepped up. I'm very impressed with what they came up with. I look forward to asking Mike if the one day concept extends into some of the lyrical motifs. If you have any insights about these things yourselves, feel free to talk about them. But there are some anomalies. I think I might be weird as an anomaly. I was playing one day in the kitchen yesterday, and my wife was kind of, she had a whole baking center set up. She was baking macarons or something like that, and it was really elaborate. But anyway, she stepped out of the room for a minute as Damien was howling, came back when Cicada was playing, which was a song that Mike sings lead on. And she's like, "Are you listening to the Foo Fighters now?" I'm like, no, it's still Fucked Up. She's like, "This is Fucked Up?" I'm like, yeah, it's Mike. It's a Mike song. But it's interesting. Like, it is stylistically dynamic, and I really appreciate that. Sorry, Sandy, your hand's up.
Well, I was going to say that one difference between when we come together in person versus virtually is, like, in person, we could say, you know, like, try and capture this vibe like this band or like this era. Like, there's more conversation to like try and find what the vibe's supposed to be. But when it's virtual and you're alone in your room and you just get these sounds coming at you, you're not getting these guides, and then you have to find the guides for yourself, right? And so that's an extra challenge, which I wonder if maybe that has led to the different components of the sound being a little bit like not the perfect fit, because we didn't really have, well, I'm just speaking for myself.
Sure.
But yeah. I didn't really have like tons of feedback or tons of like, well, very little, next to none, feedback in real time. I had to make a lot of assumptions or a lot of guesses about which kind of vibe should I go for? You know, which alley should I turn down on this song to get to the other side of, you know, the street or whatever, you know, like, because there's so many different ways, so many different routes you can take through the map of a song. And I was kind of doubting myself, like, should I be taking this alleyway and then right in that street? Or does, you know, should I go down that street and, you know, cross there? But, so that's definitely like one area where the two methods are different. And I think, you know, affected the final song and how all the different pieces mesh together.
Yeah.
The nice thing about the anomalous nature of some of these songs is there's always kind of an anomaly on a lot of the fucked up records. And I think we have gotten pretty comfortable with making these choices. And before One Day, the last two releases we had were kind of anomalous. Year of the Horse and Oberon are totally out of the regular purview of fucked up. I mean, Horse has elements of stuff that we've done before, but Oberon is,
And Dose Your Dreams as well, I would argue.
But on this record, you're right. Like, I Think I Might Be Weird is a really standout anomalous track because it's so whimsical and lighthearted. But these are the way, like, I can only imagine what the decision making or thought process or what the vibe was like in the studio when that song got put down. But it's just, you just chase it, right?
It's great.
It's a nice thing about Fucked Up is it kind of just gets handed off into the machinery and comes out, you know, goes through many steps to become fully formed. But yeah,
the backup vocals as well, Jonah, if I may, like it's lovely. Like the whole thing, the whole record, you've done a really wonderful job. Yeah.
Like in my sort of like, Alice Cooper, Pretty's for You era attempt at, backing vocals and,
well, you keep doing this hum drone thing on every record now. I think mostly, right?
That is me humming.
Yeah. What is that about? Why does this keep happening? Does it mean something?
I don't know. I'm at a crossroads here because I should just say yes, really. I'm about to start my humming career. It's true. And you heard it here first.
I'm not wrong, right? That humming has appeared on records of late.
You know what? Not to downplay it, but when you do backing vocals that aren't worded, you've got basically the vowels at your disposal. I've never really heard any backups where people are going, so, I mean, the earth is still young, maybe. Not that young. That sounds like a weird cryptic, like, yeah, okay, delete the earth is young comment. Life's a long old song. You never know. You can get some backups. But you've basically got the vowels at your disposal. Yeah. And in this case, I was singing backups, and I was in a studio here, and I was chatting with Mike and sort of sending him ideas. And we exhausted the vowels. But we wanted a sonorous, reedy, nice hum. And is a kind of good one. It's also, I don't know if you've tried to hum for a long time with sustained volume. It's pretty tough.
I haven't tried that myself. I was going to say in a long time.
A shower is just a few steps away, and it's a perfect place to, you
sure.
know.
Yeah,
road test this stuff.
I'll try humming in the shower, which sounds like a euphemism. that's lovely. Listen, I've kept you both longer than I said I would, and I apologize for that. But I do appreciate your insights. Now, this is going to be, like I said, the plan is for at least one other member of the band to join me, and I presume I may ask him if we can go out on a song from One Day, but I will also start a small debate between you two. If we wanted to go to a transitional song, let's say, or if my guest falls through and I have to go to a song, I wonder if we can choose one together right now. I'm going to ask one of you to pick. The other one has veto power. If you don't like the selection, we have a small debate, and then it goes before a parliamentary committee before a decision is rendered. Sandy, if we can go
actually, up. I think you'll find that each part of the conversation gets sent to another person without them knowing about it, and they have to respond to one word at a time.
That's right.
Within 24 hours.
That's right. Actually, you know what? I'm going to go to Jonah. Jonah, can you pick a song from One Day for us to, if not go out on, at least hear a little bit of?
I think it would be fitting to play the song One Day.
Okay. Why did you pick that?
I like elements of a lot of these songs, and I like the whole record.
Yeah.
But if I picked, I have like a few like personal deep cut likes. I mean, there's only 10 songs on here. It's can't get that deep. But this is all stuff that I find personally gratifying because of something I played or hearing my voice and thinking it sounds particularly good. But actually, I think that like maybe the best representation of what's on this record and what everybody's done towards bringing their A game performance wise one day is I think that's the standout for me.
Okay, so Sandy, you can veto this or agree. What do you make of Jonah's selection, and what do you, can we go with that?
Yes, I agree. If like I agree with pretty much everything Jonah ever says.
Shit, man. It's gonna be a dark ass day when I say something so insane that you have to be like, you know, as Jonah, we tried for so many years and we were on the same page, but now it's just no more.
It's nice to hear a bonded rhythm section.
I've said oftentimes Jonah's the best part of Fucked Up.
That's
very, very nice, and I'm sure my next guest might not appreciate that, but anyway, it's it's fine. Sandy, Jonah, it's always lovely to speak with you. Congratulations on another wonderful Fucked Up record, and best luck with everything. I hope we talk again soon.
Thanks,
Vish.
Nice to see you. Nice to hear from you. Bye.
One day I lay awake, my whole life late. Part of the long pieces of everything I ever lived before. And what it seems so sweet.
Hey Mike, how's it going?
Hey Vish, it's pretty good.
Good, I'm fine too, thanks for asking. Now, I assume you're in Toronto?
You're doing the interview, not me.
Yeah, no, it's true. You don't have to ask any questions out of courtesy or manners. How are things in Toronto today?
Worse now.
Really? Because of me?
No, I'm just kidding.
No, it's nice to see you again. I was thinking about your new record, which is great. And your colleague Damien has a song, at least one, explicitly about Toronto called Lords of Kensington. It's great. I never thought about some of the things that he'd brought up there in terms of how underground culture can actually lead to gentrification. I found that really fascinating. For you, other than living there and probably being influenced by or inspired by people, is Toronto an overt muse for you on any of these songs?
I hope not. I mean, I think the stuff that we're trying to say, or the stuff that I'm trying to say on the record, is maybe it's applicable to like a type of person and our era rather than our city. Like the stuff that I'm trying to talk about is just about a period of life. And probably, or hopefully, is something people experience regardless of where they live.
Yeah.
You know?
Like a generational thing.
Yeah, like if you're talking about gentrification, like, and the way we were trying to talk about it on the record, it's like, that's more of like a nation thing.
Yeah.
Rather, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to just talk about my neighborhood or my city or whatever, because to me that makes it too specific.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, one of the reasons I often ask people on the show where they're from, what's going on in their city, it's not just to kill time or whatever. It's because usually you learn stuff. If someone tells you about what's going on in their city, you can be like, oh, yeah, that shit's happening here, too. Or, huh, that sounds cool. I wish we were doing that. So I gather that. I think when you're an artist and you're talking about where you live and what's going on, you're reaching out into the world and other people are going to be like, yeah, that's happening here too. So you're kind of speaking universally, even if you're talking about something specific. Isn't that probably a fair way of looking at it?
Yeah, but I guess I try to obfuscate stuff when I write lyrics or whatever. Like I don't really want to talk about myself.
Yeah.
And I don't want to talk about my own specific experience. And I think all the Fucked Up records have been an exercise in me and Damien having things to say,
yeah,
but trying to cover the true intentions up in like sort of like grander concepts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that we don't actually have to talk about what we're going through ourselves.
Okay. Well, I mean, so maybe it's a time and space thing or a context thing for me. You've written a song and it kicks off the record called Found. And, I, as someone who was born and raised in Canada, can't help but when you sing about how, what's the line here? Let me just grab it so I don't screw it up. We built a highway big enough to stop time. White clouds drift by over a country found on a genocide. Now, to your earlier point, this could be almost any country. But for me, the context, and I know you as well, like to me, you're probably talking about Canada. You're saying maybe you are. Maybe you could be talking about any place.
Yeah. I mean, that song specifically, I was thinking back to when I was 20 and I was living on this road called Davenport in Toronto, which is sort of in the northern part of downtown, is a sort of a quiet, sleepy residential street. And I had a balcony, not a balcony, I had a front porch that was like three stories above the road because all the houses on Davenport are built on a bluff. And I was thinking like, oh, you know, that was such a nice house and I liked living there, and it got sold by the landlord, and so I had to move out. And it was sort of my first experience of being like forcibly moved from a place I wanted to stay. And so I was, you know, that could be a song in itself, and that's where the story could have ended. But Davenport, the street, is also one of the oldest streets in North America. It's been like it was a trading route for like 10,000 years, because the bluff that it's on was used to be the shore of Lake Iroquois, which was a giant lake that all the Great Lakes distilled out of. And I think at the time I was reading this new translation of the Aeneid by Shadi Barsh, and her intro was talking about how the book begins and ends with the same verb, and the start it means discovery and the end it means like violence or whatever. I don't remember the exact translation. And so I was thinking, like, you know, this kind of displacement, whether it's something you experience in a place you live or it's something that like you have to experience through your ancestors or what happened to your people, it's like the greater story is the one that's, I thought, more interesting and more important to talk about, right? Like, we all have to be moved around in our individual lives, but like, the thing I was trying to recognize is like, I was only there in the first place because somebody else having to be displaced from that exact spot, probably like generations and generations ago. So it's kind of like the stuff I was trying to talk about on the record was, things that I've experienced, trying to like look further into them and find your own complicity in the things that you have to experience in your own little life and your own little day, right?
Yeah, the complicity thing I recognize in a few of the songs between your lyrics and Damien's. One of the other sort of at least subtextual themes is recognizing something you've been told is different than the actual facts. I think a lot of people of our generation in Canada have had to come to terms with this. Like the things we were taught in school, depending on who your teachers were, doesn't actually match what the lived experience of so many people were. So when I think of, I mentioned Lords of Kensington, I mentioned Found, even Broken Little Boys by Damien, there's a few other examples where, does that sort of make sense to you where I'm coming from? Like this notion of we're going to try to address some from a place probably of anger, actually. The things we were told or the things we thought were happening aren't actually based on the reality of what was happening. Do you know where I'm coming from there? And do you think that's part of this record?
Maybe. I think that's just like punk, right? Or like
questioning things.
That's sort of
questioning.
That's like the founding tenet of like whatever alternative culture you find yourself in, right? It's like whether it's punk or like being an anti-vaxxer or whatever, like the whole spectrum of like people that have decided that the prevailing sentiments that they come across in their life are false and sort of dedicate themselves to, you know, believing something else or fighting for something else. And yeah, that's probably like everybody has a bit of that in them. And the more of it you have in you, the further you go into whatever culture you ended up in. And yeah, like I think Damien's the Kensington song, me and Damien have a lot of memories of spending a lot of time in that neighborhood, right? Like in the late 90s, that's where Who's Emma was.
That's where you and I basically probably first met, right? At Who's Emma.
Yeah. And that was sort of like us as late teenagers, sort of like where we first like learned to stake our claim on like a piece of land. You know, if you want to talk about it like that, like I can remember making posters that were like these sarcastic bullshit posters that were like, you know, punks own this corner of the city. Like if you're a mod or whatever, like stay out, in like a joking sort of ridiculous confrontational way. But it really was us being like, we have found something in this area, right? Like there was venues, other bands like us hung out. I remember Zoe used to do like punk film nights in Kensington. And when you're a kid, you know, that feels exciting and you feel like making a claim on a space is like a very important part of building an identity and a culture. But looking back at it 20 years ago, you see how things change and you can only extrapolate like how things must have changed in order for you to get there in the first place, right? Like we thought Kensington was like this paradise, and looking back on it now that it's being more gentrified, it's easy enough for us to be like, well, it sucks and things used to be a lot better. But there were probably like, you know, old Hungarian people and older Jewish people who had been moved out by people like us who were probably saying the same thing.
Right.
When we were discovering how cool this place was because of the stamp we were trying to put on it.
Yeah, I don't think of you as a nostalgic person, but I think you're correct. Everyone has a good old days that you may not even realize. And you may not realize that you're infringing upon their current good days. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Now, one of the there's a few different aspects of the making of this record that I want to get to. But since we're on the lyrics part of the record, this is Damien's first full-fledged batch of lyrical contributions since, what, 2014? Is that correct?
For an
actual album. Can you talk a little bit about why you think it's been so long? And can you also talk about what kind of conversations you two had about him contributing lyrics again?
Well, after the Glass Boys, we all kind of took like a little bit of a break to figure what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he did his wrestling TV show and he was doing a lot of hosting stuff. And we only did one record, really, like one full length between now and then.
Dose Your Dreams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I just sort of caught on an idea with that. And he was into just letting me follow it. And that record, I like being collaborative and I like writing. I like both of us. My preference is both of us writing. But the last record, Dose Your Dreams, kind of was like, that's like a singular project, right? All of that stuff. That's like so weird and expansive that it just has to come from one person's head, I feel like, the music or the lyrics. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't really like a conversation, you know, he was just doing other stuff in his life. And then I think after years of that, you sort of like probably develop a certain like consternation around writing again. And I think he just had to swing back into it. Hmm. Yeah. And we sort of sat down and came up with some general vibes for this record. But like, even though there's like a contrived concept, I don't think either of us really wanted it to be like this massive, another big fucked up concept album, because we'd just done like, you know, 10 in a row or whatever.
Well, you like concepts. You like there to be a singular vision behind whatever record you're putting out. I hope I'm not misspeaking. That's fair, right?
I like the shield of it, right? I like for this there to be this like artistic scaffolding for people to talk about instead of talking about like what my feelings are about things.
Right. Well, that's the obfuscation part too, I think. Maybe.
Yeah.
A little bit, right? Like you get people talking about, I don't want to say gimmick. That is disparaging, but you come up with a narrative around a record. And like people like me will ask you about the narrative as opposed to the actual maybe substance sometimes. And then I think, Mike, you get frustrated that no one's asking you about the substance. They're only asking you about the concept. Am I capturing some of your feelings on how the press cycle can go?
Yeah, I think that I kind of just gave, like, I didn't want to be like a musician or an artist or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't even, you know me a little bit personally. I don't really like sharing stuff and I don't go out of my way tell people about how I'm feeling about things.
Right.
But I found myself as someone who like has to do that professionally and like write lyrics and tell people how I feel about the world every couple of years. And so I think a lot of my contributions to the band have been, yeah, to put like a force field around that, whether it's like doing a rock opera about another character or like the Zodiac stuff. I like being able to say that I'm doing something because it needs to fulfill this obligation, right? Like,
uh-huh.
oh, we have to make another record because we're going to do these one day things, or like we have to do the last couple Zodiac things, right? Like, I don't want to just like wake up and be like, let me tell the world about this idea I had.
Yeah.
I need to put like a, yeah, like another layer in front of it. And I think I sort of recognized early on that like people who talk about our music, they sort of, yeah, you gravitate towards that. And I find that, and yeah, this is probably my own doing, but like the music doesn't really get discussed as much as you'd assume, right? It's like, yeah, every time we put a record out, it's always talking about the contrivances, like how long the record, like every fucked up review has the amount of minutes the record is, like every single one, which is strange, right? Like, you don't talk about a painting and talk about how many inches the canvas is, but literally every single fucked up review is like, can you believe that this record is X amount of minutes and seconds?
Yeah, that's,
and yeah,
fair enough. I mean, I think I was talking to Sandy and Jonah about this in terms of why I think the band is beloved. And I think we landed on the fact that for some of us, beyond the music, it's the spirit of the thing. It's the spirit of ambition and scale and camaraderie and community and all that kind of stuff. So because that's, and then that can be at the fore because you, by your own admission, like you call them, you say that it's contrived, I suppose, but it's an interesting thing for a punk to do, to like, okay, everyone, I've come up with some parameters for a project. Now let's see how far we can push against those parameters that I've imposed, that we've imposed upon ourselves. That seems to be a constant. And then, yes, the minutes, I don't know about that part of it, but I think people, when they're writing or writing about the band or covering the band, they can't help but be in awe of the scale of each record, of the mission statement for each record can't help but make it into our appreciation for what you've done. But you're right, that can take up the first 200 words of a review when you're just like, that's just part of it. It's not the only thing that's part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a lot of it has to do with like, it's hard for people to take punk music seriously, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I sort of had this idea that like all of the innovation in like in alternative music comes from punk, right? Mm-hmm. Punk is like a very serious form of music, and it like really changed the musical landscape in Western culture.
Yep.
But, you know, it's still always treated as like a novelty when a punk band gets popular, or if a punk band releases a record that like has chops or whatever, or has like interesting ideas, because for whatever reason, punk music just isn't taken as seriously as like indie rock or whatever. Right. There isn't like, punk music doesn't have the stuff around it, like the like big professional like review culture or the big magazines. It's just sort of seen as like, and I found this in our own career, right? Like, we've been pretty well reviewed and we've done a lot of interesting things, but it's like, it's always treated as like this novelty when we come up with a cool idea or a good record. It's never really dealt with head on that like the music is good or the band is good.
Well,
it's always like, can you believe that they've done this crazy thing? And it's like, we're just trying to make records like everyone else.
But I think this is true of, and forgive me if this is embarrassing for you to hear, but I think this is true of most revolutionary thinkers, if you will. And I would suggest a lot of punk is seated in revolution of like, things don't have to be the way they've conventionally been. I find that anyone who proposes any kind of revolutionary thought or thoughts that, to me, they're always rooted in common sense and logic, but people ascribe revolution to them or impracticality to them. And then the people who are behind them, the proponents, are viewed as self-righteous or some bullshit. Like, it's a way of kind of, I don't know if people feel guilty that they can't be a vegetarian or be worried about the climate or worried about their communities. Oh, that's just some bleeding heart, impractical utopian mindset. Of course we can't do that. That person's a nut. Like, you know where I'm coming from? Like, in my history of the people I most admire have been ridiculed. And when I think, and I don't know if that says something about me, but often there are people who are like, yeah, we got to change something. And there's just like a concerted effort to be like, we can't change anything. And I mean, we're going through that right now with the pandemic and the climate change stuff. And I think punk is sort of part of that, if that makes sense. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I don't think that Fucked Up is like a revolutionary band. And I think that we're sort of like, we have these weird novelty ideas, but like we're sort of conventional in the presentation of our music, right? Like, I think that we're like, if I had to look back on Fucked Up's oeuvre or whatever, I would say that we're weird people trying to make normal music instead of the other way around, right? Yeah. And I think that like the other way around is more revolutionary, right? Like normal people trying to make weird music, like that,
right.
That sort of jumps out more than I feel like what we've been trying to do. Like we started out as like an aesthetic exercise of like, me and Damien were really into Danger House Records and the way those records sounded and the way they looked. And that's why Fucked Up exists pretty much, is like that and a couple other things. We really started out as like an aesthetic exercise of being like, can we mimic this way of putting out art? And that's like the least revolutionary thing you can do.
Sure.
And I think that like we've been doing versions of that for a whole career, right? Like the last record was like me trying to cover a book like Ulysses by James Joyce, which is like a very modernist approach to making art rather than like I don't set out to make stuff that sounds like things no one ever has heard before, right? I'm just sort of a weird person trying to make music that I think sounds normal.
No, that's fair. And when I think of Fucked Up, I don't just think of it as a band anymore. I mean, given our history together and the work we've sort of done together, like I think about Long Winter. I think about other things that you've helped spearhead. And that's what I mean. It's a galvanization of weirdos, but in a normal way, I suppose. Like I think I know where you're coming from. But that's what I'm talking about. Like, it's not just the band. It's the way the band operates. It's the way the band often brings in new people into the, whether they tour with you or whether you just try to play shows with them or organizations. Like, all of that to me is beyond just being a band. So, and I don't know if you were too close to it, but one day, as you look back on it, there's going to be...
pun?
Well, yeah, I guess it was a bit of an album nod. One day when you look back on it, though, I think you will see that the actions of this band, there will be that degrees of separation exercise that could be done of all the people you've interacted with or impacted in some way, whether that's in the audience, whether that's people who end up in bands, whether it's the bands you've worked with. So again, I'm not trying to embarrass you or foist too much upon you in this regard. But I think that's part of the band. And so when you make records like these, and we'll get to the kind of concept of this one in a moment, I think that's what people are reacting to. Like, I guess I don't see it as derision. I think when Fucked Up release a record and the concept of it is explained to you, for me, I smile a little. Oh, fuck. They did it again. They're at it again. And it's not a novelty for me. It's just like, oh, great. This is exciting. Like I smile. I get the press release. I hear the songs and or whatever comes with it. And I'm like, this is great. This is the spirit of what I of music that I enjoy and creative endeavors that I enjoy. Pushing the envelope, all the cliches. But you do that. So I'm on a ramble. I just want to say I hear that. And I can appreciate your reticence to be thought of as revolutionaries. But as we look back at some point, I think that's going to be clear. All right? Can you agree with that?
sure, some parts of it. I mean, I think that the band had, there's two things going on, right? Like the band, I think we've always tried to have a certain generosity in Fucked Up, right? Whether it's like putting out way too much music, you know, all the records have too many minutes. And yeah, I think that that's just the inevitability of, and coming back to like place and community and locality and stuff, right? Like we didn't form as a band. We just formed as like people who had met each other because of punk and this very specific community. And I'll say it again, like in Kensington Market, right? Like we all started hanging out at Who's Emma and places like that when we were 17, 16 and 17. We sort of learned how to be people through interacting with that really weird niche community, right? Yeah. Like we were meeting weirdos when we were teenagers, and that imprinted on all of us, right? Like how to live your life and how to treat people. And yeah, like how to do your art and how to do your band. And so we didn't form as this desire to like make it as musicians, and none of us really were. You know, when we formed Fucked Up, three of the five members didn't really know how to play their instruments.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like we were on another trip. And I feel like that if there's any sentiment that I'd like to come through with the band is that, right? Like I like making music, but we're more an exercise in spreading a certain kind of community feeling.
Yeah.
Into whatever we're doing, which that yeah. I feel like is what people responded to, right? Like you get it when we were really big, it was because people like you're getting a glimpse into something that is interesting, right?
Yeah.
And there's this weird music that's coming with it. And I think like, if you look at stuff like Turnstile, right, they're popular. I mean, their records are good, but also they're giving a wider audience a glimpse into this like magical world that you need to be invited into kind of. Mm-hmm. And that's because they come out of a community rather than coming out of like wanting to be musicians.
Yeah, that's fair. I want to go back to, I appreciate what you're saying, although, I mean, I'm starting, when I think of a song like Nothing's Immortal, which I can't recall, is that one of yours or Damien's?
Damien.
Yeah, so this is an interesting sort of recognition of being a part of something, but wondering if you're outside of it now. I can't help wondering if this isn't my thing anymore. And the subtext of this is, it begins with, I keep hearing the same old punk song echoing around my head. There's something kind of eerie about it. I hope they'll play it when I'm dead. There is this sort of recognition that, I don't know, I couldn't help but wonder, is the narrator of this song talking about aging out of something they're a part of?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a question for Damien. Do you feel that a little bit?
Well, I think this is this kind of thing Last Boys was about, like knowing that you're just one person in a lineage, right? Like,
yeah,
that's sort of what our version of community is as well. Like understanding that you're doing things in order for the people who listen to you to learn how to do them in a similar way. Right. And that's the benefit of coming from punk or coming from like an artistic community, is that like you have to learn it from someone.
Yeah.
In order to teach it to someone.
Well, but what I'm, yeah, and I appreciate that, but I want to, like, in the biographical info that comes with this record, Damien says something like, it almost felt like it might be the last time I'd ever get to record vocals for anything. And mm-hmm. in talking with Sandy and Jonah, Sandy sort of said, and I think she treats every Fucked Up record this way, to be honest, or has for the last 10 years. She sort of said, like, this could be the last time we make a record. There's always this sense of, like, or rather, what I'm getting at is at least two members are conveying, like, this could be it. And we've been hearing about Damien. There was a point, I don't know which album cycle it was, where he may not even sing with us anymore. Like, there's just always this sense of pensive, is this going to end kind of stuff. Do you feel that as well, or do you think they're just, is that just something within the band that you don't understand?
I mean, Damien likes, that's Damien's thing he likes to say every time we make a record, right? He has a very like Ben de Sikla, if I'm pronouncing that right, sort of take to it, right? Like he likes the grandness of wrapping things up, you know, like he's really into that band Integrity, and their whole thing is like glamorizing the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And I think he sees a real appeal in that, right? And so he says, this might be my last record, we might break up. He says I like every interview he's ever done.
Yeah.
Just part of like his aesthetic. I always have about 900 Fucked Up records that are in process.
Yeah.
So I know that I'm going to be busy with this band for like the next 20 years at least.
Yeah. So it's just, I don't know if it's a self-defense thing where they're like, they love it so much that, or anyone in the band, they love it so much that they're willing to let it go, like, or convey that if they have to let it go, they don't love it as much as they actually do. I don't know how to put this exactly, but it seems a little like undercutting expectation even. To say, well
I think, I mean, it's a bluff, right?
Yeah.
But I think this time around specifically, I think a lot of people thought that about everything, right? We just come out of a global pandemic.
Are we out of it? I didn't know we were out of it. I thought it was still happening.
Well, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. No,
people are going to say shit like that about everything. You know, this might be the last time I go to the grocery store.
Yes, exactly. Or this. Yeah, that's actually literally what Sandy said at one point. She was leaving a sound check on her bike and was like,
"Yeah, that's sort of what the record is trying to address, right? Like, yeah. Sure, this might be the last time you write lyrics. But also, like, this might be the last time you do anything, right? Like,
yeah."
It's a bullshit sentiment to just be like, live every day like it's your last one, which is not really what I'm trying to say. But like, you know, you can contain your whole life into one day and imagine that it's the last time or the first time that you do anything that you have to do.
Yeah.
It just depends on how you want to think about stuff.
I want to get to this one day thing, as I keep saying, I will in a moment. But you said a couple of things that I want to go back to, one of which was about your own sort of role as a public figure, how you obfuscate things a little bit and try not to make yourself the center of whatever's going on. However, I will tell you, one of the loveliest songs on this record is Cicada, and that's sung by you. I noticed you singing lead on Dose Your Dreams as well. So the last two records is what I'm getting at is, and over at least the last two proper albums, you are stepping out a bit. You are coming up to the microphone and singing more. So some sort of evolution has occurred there. Like you are, I believe what you're saying when you say you're trying to create a little filter between you and your personal self and your public self, but you're singing more and singing more directly. Can you talk a little bit about what's prompted that?
Well, I used to sing in a band when I was like 16, and I didn't like it. It was very nerve wracking to sing on stage. And I think we only played a couple shows, and the last round of touring, we did the song that I sing a few times live and I hated doing it. So we took out of the set list, but we got some good feedback for that song. And on the last record I sang, I don't know, just sort of to try it. And I was really experimenting with different voices on Dose Your Dreams, and it felt kind of like a gimme to just, you know, sing one myself, and it sounded pretty good. And so I wanted to do it again, but I don't like the act of singing. Right. And I certainly don't want to do it on stage. And I don't think I've ever like said a word into a microphone on a fucked up stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not my thing, but in the same way, I like putting guitar stuff together. I like putting vocal tracks together. I like assembling that song. And I like trying to convey stuff in that way. So I'll definitely do it again on record. I can't say for sure if people will ever hear me sing on stage, but I like doing it.
Okay, I can appreciate that. But again, it's a standout song. It's not just because it's... also, I mean, you and Jonah do these amazing backup vocals throughout the record. It sounds really great. So
Jonah does backups.
Oh, you don't do any of them?
I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, so. Those sound great too, is all I'm getting at. It's obviously a nice kind of contrast between Damien's voice and... which is more guttural, and your voice on Cicada and Jonah's voice, which are cleaner. Anyway, it's just great. I love that song as well. I look forward to it. It's one of those things that comes towards the end of the record, but by the end of the record, towards the end of the record just changes all of a sudden, changes character. So I really appreciate that. And I want to, as we talk about One Day more, maybe we'll get into the lyrical content of that song, because I couldn't help notice in the credits that a lot of the people you pay tribute to in the traditional thank you section of a record are people who have passed away. I don't think that's exclusively that, but this is a record reflecting, and Cicada, I think, is a song that reflects upon such people as well. Loss was on your mind on that song and potentially on this record as a whole. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, moving on with loss. Yeah, I think like, the record was sort of conceived before COVID,
yeah,
but most of the work was done during. And I don't think we wanted to like make a COVID record or like make a pandemic commentary really with this record. In fact, like I wanted to shy away from from overly talking about it. But yeah, I mean, everybody lost stuff in the last couple. Like, it's crazy. It's crazy that we can just sort of even move on like this and have a semblance of normality. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
no, absolutely. I deal with this every day.
Thinking back, like, you know, you put something like the whatever the Spanish flu, you know, I'm going to sound like a fucking moron, but like, thinking back without knowing any of the specifics, you can just imagine there being like a 10 or 15 year period of like readjustment for the whole planet after something like that. Yeah. And here we are going through it, still just like having to worry about our jobs and money and stuff. When everyone has gone through this global catastrophe that like is still happening, and just like, not only the physical damage it did, but just like all this like psychic violence that's happening. It's crazy that anyone is still sane.
Yeah, it's I agree. And I think one of the reasons I've been drawn to art and art making is both because I find it fulfilling to consume or make it, but I also think it's probably a distraction. I have this view of comedy where I think comedy is really staving off despair. Comedy has really been under attack because of how dark it can be over the last few years.
You love to laugh.
Well, I just think,
if you're feeling despair,
I do think we engage with things like to kill time a little bit and also to stave off despair. And I assume, you know, I talked to people, like one of the things that comes up nowadays is people say, I can't sleep. I'm so distraught. And one of the things they say is to exercise. And one of the things we do, and that's, I think, basically to exhaust yourself. So your body can't keep you awake. Your mind can't keep you awake. You do some stuff during the day. And I think music, like just consuming art, is a way of getting through the day. As much as I love it and it helps me on so many levels, it has come to mind in recent years that I really need this shit to take my mind off of how fucked up everything is. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I guess so. It depends what kind of art you're looking at, I suppose.
Well, I mean, there's probably part of you, if you think about it existentially, like, do you ever think about like, why the hell am I doing this? Why do I have 900 fucked up records on the go? I mean, on some level you're being a productive person, but do you ever think about like, what am I sorry, this is what I go through sometimes. Like, what am I doing? Why do I do all this stuff? Do you ever have that?
No, I mean, about certain things, right? Like,
yeah,
I think about that stuff a lot in my personal life.
Yeah,
but with the band is the one thing I'm very direct with, and I, you know, I make music because that's what I like to do,
right?
And I'm lucky to be able to do that for my primary thing. But I don't ever question really that. I don't have a lot of existential stuff around it.
Okay,
and because I'm not trying to deal with, you know, my music isn't necessarily about stuff like that, right? I try to always have fucked up songs be like very uplifting and positive and have like a very propulsive view of life.
Yeah.
But yeah, I make music because that's what I like to do.
Fair enough. All right. Well, let's get to this concept then, because I've been skirting around it for some time. One day as a concept, I in talking to Sandy and Jonah, I believe the word stipulations was raised. Because both of them were like, yeah, Mike, I got Jonah in particular is like, I got an email saying you know what? I'm not going to explain it. You explain it, Mike. How did the concept for one day come to you? How did it begin to sort of blossom with your bandmates? And within that, can you talk about some of the stipulations? I'm particularly interested in the one where you asked Jonah not to listen to anything before he got to the studio. That's one that I found interesting. Can you talk a little bit about the overall concept and how you came up with these sort of, I don't want to call them rules. Let's go with stipulations.
You can say rules. Nothing wrong with a couple of rules.
I guess they're rules. Yeah. Can you talk about
that? I mean, we had a lot of rules when we started out the band. The rules were we weren't allowed to say anything on stage. We weren't allowed to stop between songs. And there might have been another one, but I can't remember. I'm very into rules.
Why is that?
Artistic rules, because that sort of goes along with like the OCD-ness of fucked up, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So we were talking about before, like everything needing to be in a little pen in order to push against. But this record was more just about trying to come up with a little like exercise to freshen things up, right? Like it was conceived just as like a little musical drill. Like, do you think that we could do this? Do you think we could, I could make up this many songs in this short amount of time? And we had just spent, I just spent the pandemic like doing all the Year of the Horse stuff and like teasing it out months and months. It was like a year and a half release window. And that record took like 6 years to make. Like I had gone through so many personal changes in my life between when we started Horse and when it came out. It was just insane, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, enough of this. Because when you have that much time in the studio, whatever you're working on just morphs. It just morphs out of your control and it becomes something else on its own terms, right? You have too much time to play with EQs or fiddle the knobs or whatever. It just, the work distanced itself from its inspiration. And so I wanted to come up with a way where those two things were the same, right? The work and the inspiration were the same thing. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is just like to just do it and not look back on it. And so, you know, I make music. So the obvious pen for that kind of idea is a full length, is an album, right? Because that's what we make. And so it's just like the thing that I do as a person, to think my chosen profession is making albums. Could I do what I do completely in the span of one day, right? And, you know, it's just one of those other things that we were talking about before where like as like a 40-year-old man, that feels fantastical to, you know, it's like this whimsical thing of like, ooh, could I do this thing in one day? But it's like as a teenager, we would have approached making a record as like, okay, we have $200. We can afford 12 hours in a studio and you would just make your record. And
yeah,
one day. Wouldn't be any of the hoopla. There wouldn't be any of the hoopla,
yeah.
The contrivances, you know?
Yeah.
But when you have the 20 years of like artistic baggage, this is the kind of thing that helps, I feel like helps to strip that away. And the thing I was thinking of a lot when I was actually recording was like, this is just going to show me exactly what kind of music I make, right? When it's just me, like my hand and my guitar and the microphone, and there's not going to be 2 years of changing it or manipulating it. It's just going to be directly what comes out of me. I just really wanted to figure out what kind of player I was. And so that's what I did.
Yeah, it sounds like you were trying to draw upon your own instinctual impulses as opposed to overthinking and giving yourself the benefit of, yeah, just lots of time. So that's you and your motivation. Jonah in particular said that you told him when you sent him these parts that you came up with on guitar that he had to go to the studio and hear them for the first time. Is that part of that impulsive, instinctual thing you were hoping? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I didn't want anyone to have the opportunity. Well, it's like me and Damien, we took some liberties with writing lyrics. Cause that's a different track.
Yeah.
But I didn't want anyone to be able to ruminate on what they were going to do. Right. I just wanted them to do it. So yeah, he sequestered himself in like Leeds or Wales or something for a couple of days with an engineer and he just did it.
Yeah, and Sandy said Sandy did something similar. That's right. Now, you mentioned you and Damien in terms of the lyrics. So were there any parameters on the lyric writing in terms of this one day concept?
No, I didn't want to have any guest vocalists. That was one thing I was adamant on. I wanted all the sounds on the record just to come from the five of us, the four of us, since Josh didn't play guitar on this one.
Yeah. I assume that was for just personal reasons, but is that weird for you to have no Josh?
He didn't play on Dozer Dreams or Horse.
Yeah. So what's going on there exactly?
You have to ask him.
He's busy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He doesn't, I don't think he gets a lot out of like playing guitar on albums. You know what I mean?
He likes the shows.
He likes the shows. He likes the gang of it.
Yeah.
He likes going on tour. You know, not everybody has to like every facet of being in a band.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
But yeah, me and Damien, again, like I didn't need there to be an extra layer of like all the lyrics are going to be about this because then it just becomes like too rigid. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But did you collaborate again? Like we established earlier, like Damien has written more lyrics on this record than he has since Glass Boys. Did you work together on them in any way? Him helping you, you helping him?
No, I mean, we talked back and forth. We talked about it, but I couldn't imagine writing lyrics with another person. That seems very weird to me.
Oh, you never like trade off or collaborate with him or anything?
Not for years. Oh. No, I don't know how I would even do that.
Well, is it a, okay, here's an idea. One of you comes up with your, what you think is the done, it's finished. Yeah. You use email or text or some sort of delivery service and you say, hey, what do you think? That doesn't come to mind. Like, what if he said something that was totally out of left field on one of these songs? Like, would you not be like, I don't know about this?
We're both too touchy, I think, to be able to do that. I think we understand that, like, that would be chaotic.
Oh, okay. Okay, so
that's like antimatter coming into contact with matter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
what about compliments? What about, hey, man, you really... So I sent Damien a note to tell him how much I appreciated the lyrics to both Lords of Kensington and Broken Little Boys, because I found them rather... I just really appreciated them. They got me thinking about a lot of different things. And if he were...
What did he say?
No, Damien does not respond to my texts or emails.
Oh, yeah.
But I told him, like, I just thought it was great. So it was one-sided conversation thus far. Yeah. I only emailed him a couple of days ago. So maybe he'll respond. It's the holidays, or it's the end of the holidays. But...
I mean, we kudosed each other for sure, but there wasn't any, like, meddling in, why don't you change this word or talk about something else?
I appreciate how you want to... or would want to potentially... keep some mystery to your own lyrics in terms of this context. Like, I don't want to ask you too much.
You can give me compliments about them like you did Damien.
I thought, in particular Found and Cicada really speak to me. Cicada is hitting me in a particular place because I've lost some friends and some of the friends I've lost, I mean, we're losing some of our heroes every day, and some of them are people who documented their lives via records or films or books. So Cicada in particular, I know you didn't want to make a pandemic record, and the context is the context. Cicada could probably have been written in any year, but it feels particularly poignant to me. I've given you some kudos on it already, but it's just really struck me in a profound way, that song, if for what that's worth. The notion that people are still here even after they're gone in the wrong hands can be a Hallmark card, but you've done a really wonderful job. And the notion of a cicada, why a cicada? Because the cicada, as I understand it, is a little insect that we hear buzzing often in the summer. Is that the one?
Yeah.
It just creates this hum. And you never know where it's coming from. I thought that was a beautiful image, that this sound is just always with us. I presume you're mostly pondering musicians that have been lost, or were there any particular people that came to mind when you wrote that song?
Well, one specific friend of ours had a connection to cicadas, and they would appear under his balcony every year, and he would document them and make posts about them. And to me, it was just like, there's a metaphor in that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a tribute to him, and that the connection is very direct, but also like the metaphor in the cicada is they live underground and they germinate for like 15 or 17 years or something before they like spring up. And that's kind of what punk, that's what our experience in punk is, right?
Yeah.
We like make our music and no one can hear it because it's under the ground. And every generation, like one of us comes up and reverberates to like the whole world. Yeah. And that's what this person did, right? He was like a once in a generation voice, and he developed with all of us in the mud and in the dirt. And then he like sprang out and everyone heard his voice. And so that's sort of that's what the song is. And when we were finishing it, we were doing it at this nice studio in a coach house in Toronto, and it was summertime, and there was all these cicadas like singing in the trees. And so that's what the sound is at the start of the song, is us recording that those sounds happening while we were like finishing that specific song, which was quite cool.
Yeah, that's lovely. I mean, I asked Jonah about some of the humming that he's been engaged in on, I think, a few different recent Fucked Up records. That yeah. also reminded me, it's not, I don't believe that's, no, it has nothing to do with that song, Cicada, but...
He hums on track 3.
I think he hums at the... Yeah, does he not... by the way, I also compliment... The other song that I think I wrote to you right away, I Think I Might Be Weird, is a really yeah. fantastic song, but it's the one that I was first... It's the second song, I believe, on the record. And I was like, what the hell? What the hell is this?
Yeah.
And I've grown to love it. I've just grown to just... I'm like, this is my one of my favorite Fucked Up songs now. I don't know what the lyrics are very mystifying to me. Do you want to say anything about that real quick?
So I Think I Might Be Weird. I have a little bit of like a nautical theme that runs through Fucked Up.
Yeah.
For some reason, like I'm not the most nautical person in the band, as has been well documented. Jonah literally lives on a boat, but I like being on a boat. Like I have been on a couple cruises that I think are fantastic. Fucked Up played on a cruise. We also took, on my insistence, because I didn't want to fly, we took a ferry, a 2-day ferry from Osaka to Shanghai through wow. some of the globe's choppiest seas. And on our concept album, David Comes to Life, there's a song where the action leaves its setting and it takes place on a ship, which is called Ship of Fools. And in the last couple of years, I've been just reading a lot of like old white guy stuff, like the Greeks, you know, the Odyssey and stuff like that. And there's, it's just all ships all the way down and oceans and, you know, wine, dark sea and all that nonsense. And when I was writing this record, again, I didn't want there to be this like overarching theme. And I had that title in my head for a long time. I think it has a nice ring to it. I Think I Might Be Weird. Something that might shock you is that a lot of people have said that I'm weird in my life. Like it's something I hear a lot. You're weird.
Flummoxed. I can't believe this might have occurred.
So it's something that I think about a lot, not a lot, but you know, and the song takes place on a ship. It's just sort of a capsule story about a guy who comes to one and he realizes he's on a boat and he very quickly realizes he's not like everyone else on the ship. He's not supposed to be there. And he's being carried off to a destiny that isn't his, against his will. And he's trying to escape. And I just sort of wrote it as like a nice rhyming story. Like I didn't have really an intention to it. I just liked putting the syllables and the stuff together. And
yeah.
It's really like, bah, 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 bah.
Yeah.
But you know, as you do after I wrote it, I was like, oh, that's my life experience. As being a weird person, just like finding yourself coming to you on a ship that isn't your own.
Yeah.
Being carried off to a destiny that you don't recognize, you know?
Well, so that's an interesting way of putting it, because I was pondering, there's a few things I forgot to do in the last bit there, which was to ask you if you'd be interested in telling us who you were specifically thinking of with Cicada, but I can also appreciate why you'd maybe not want to do that. Before I go much further, did you want to divulge who inspired that song?
I mean, it's very obvious who that song is about, but people are going to listen to that song and want to connect it to their own life. So it's more about that.
Okay, fair enough. So the other thing I wanted to get to beyond I Think I Might Be Weird being somewhat fantastically autobiographical is I wonder, because he's not here and I likely won't get to ask him about it, do you have an overarching perception of where Damien was coming from with these songs? Because unlike you, who I think like you admit or state, you will obfuscate some of your personal experience to be more universal in what you're conveying lyrically. Damien's songs on this record seem particularly personal. A lot of I pronoun usage. And when I hear, particularly when you read the lyrics, you're like, oh yeah, I've heard him address some of these things in the past in interviews or even in songs.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm getting a personal sense of where he's at. There's the devotion. There's the questioning and anxiety. As we suggested earlier, I think his own sense of complicity in making the world better and potentially worse at the same time. Anyway, that's my reading of it. What's your take on where he's kind of at, where he was at when he was writing these songs?
I think Damien's sort of like artistic guise is a guy trying to reckon with his success and his like transgressions, right? Like,
yeah,
there's a lot of, the word isn't like Catholic or whatever, but there's that sort of vibe in a lot of Damien's stuff where he uses lyrics as confessionals, right?
Well, it's very religious. I mean, it seems very religious.
A lot of Damien's early lyrics are just, they're all religious stuff, right? And a lot of that's to do with this, like trying to atone for something, but also just like using it as an interesting spiritual metaphor, which is like a lot of punk does.
Yep.
And sort of like, you know, we were both early on in the band, we were both like probing mysticism, and I was doing it from like a nature way, and he was doing it from a spiritual way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and this is what he goes into a lot of his interviews too, right? Like he has always been reckoning with his own success and feeling like undeserving of it.
Yeah.
And Damien's personal life, right? Like the word isn't success again, but like he's had a lot of success in his personal life, right? Like he's done a lot of amazing things. He has a really amazing family. Mm-hmm. He's gotten himself into a place where he wanted. And it's the same way with him in his artistic life, right? Like there's something to both of us where we weren't really good at doing anything else. We're not really employable. And we ended up in a band just because that's what we were good at doing. But Damien specifically is like the kind of charisma that he has. You can't imagine him anywhere but in front of a bunch of people on a stage with a microphone, right?
Yeah.
He seems like called to that, but he doesn't take things lightly. And the last 10 years, 15 years of his lyrics have, I think, all been about feeling guilty about achieving like exactly what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where there's an anxiety in a lot of his words, especially on this record. You know what I mean? Like looking at his peers and seeing how peers have changed and pondering how that reflects on him and his own ideas. You know what I mean? Like it seems on a little bit of a shaky ground, but yeah, I don't know. That's been my take kind of on his lyrics.
Well, and I think if we want to push the one day concept we really only talked about it so far in terms of the process, but you've alluded to it a few times. I'm sure Damien feels the same, like this notion of how your life can change in one day, the mysticism around that, the fact that it just like in a sort of random moment, your whole life can change for better or for worse. I think that's probably permeating some of his lyrics as well.
Yeah, like I certainly can pinpoint moments that set my life in a different direction, and I'm sure he can too.
Yeah.
I think the difference between us is that I always try to, I'm a very negative person, but with the band, I try to compensate for that by making the band seem very uplifting.
Yeah.
And he's the opposite, right? Like he's a very jovial, nice, friendly guy.
Yeah.
But in the band, he's airing out his anxieties,
yeah,
and sort of like his guise is a frustrated person.
That's interesting, huh? That's who better to encapsulate the dynamic between
him, maybe.
Well, yeah, him, but yeah, I don't think he'll respond to my emails. Anyway, it's a lot to think about and a lot to chew on one day. It's another wonderful record. You said you've got 900. Potentially 900 fucked up records on the go at any given time. Knowing you the way I do, I wouldn't be surprised if you already have another fucked up album done. What can you tell us about future plans for the band? Oh, and by the way, I know you're planning to tour as much as you possibly can. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these things? Is it a really extensive tour? And within that, what I was saying a moment ago, what else is coming beyond one day?
In terms of records that you can, or tours?
That you can share. Well, both things, I guess. The touring, let's start with the touring. The touring is going to be pretty extensive, is that correct? And expensive.
Expensive.
It's both. It's probably going
to
be both.
We're going to do the normal touring that you do.
Okay.
We're going to go to all those spots.
Yep.
Yeah, we have a lot of records that we're working on.
Oh, good.
We have a bunch of Zodiac records left to do, so those are being worked on.
So the people telling me or saying in public, this could be the last one, are they saying this knowing there's like 15 other, 20, 30, whatever you said, 900 other things?
Well, I think only one person has been saying that. We know why that's the case.
No, I think two. At least two people in the band have conveyed it. One in the bio for this record. I haven't spoken to Damien directly, but Sandy also said like her approach to working on One Day was like, this could be it. So I'm going to do, I think what she, if I recall correctly, and people have already heard it on this episode, she said she was trying to give it her all and realized she was actually overplaying because she thought this could be it. So she wanted to go all out and then realize that wasn't actually serving the song. So she brought it down a notch. But that mentality, whatever, I think there's just a, we've gone over it. It sounds to me that there's no reason for them to.
Do you think that this could be the last time we talk to each other? That's why you have so many questions.
Well, by the same token that you're, I don't really often think about things this way, but sure, it could be. I could stop doing this. You could stop wanting to talk to me.
This could be your last podcast ever.
It could be. This is getting a little morbid. I don't want it to be, but it could be. Yeah, it could be. I mean, that's what, it's funny that you talk about being very positive. The concept of One Day is a little dark.
Well,
the notion the that, good, that.
But it's, you know, the intention for me was never, the record isn't called The Last Day.
No, I know.
It's called What, like,
I know.
The promise of One Day is that you get another one tomorrow.
Absolutely. I said that to someone recently too. Like, if we bombed this interview, we'll both do other ones and make up for it.
Well, I can tell you, we definitely will be doing this interview again.
I don't agree. I think it went very well.
Because we both overcompensated and we got to tone it down a notch.
No, I don't agree. I think this was really lovely. Okay. And Mike, where can people go to learn more about Fucked Up on the computers and the telephones?
Like, you want my phone number?
Yeah. Give us your phone number right now and we'll all call you. No, is there like websites, Instagram, social media?
Does Fucked Up have an Instagram? Yes.
Yeah. And you've got, are you sticking with the Twitter, even though it seems to be falling apart?
Well, I signed up for host.
Yeah, so did I.
Just to grab the URL.
Yeah.
Fucked Up.
Yeah.
And then I signed up for whatever the other one is, the colorful one.
Hive?
Yeah. But then I just deleted it from my, just, yeah. Nothing's changing.
Do you feel like, I did it. I got the Mastodon, the Hive, and the Post. But I just...
You got it before all the other Vishkatas?
There are a billion of us, you know. It's like Bill Smith in India.
You know how many Halachuks there are in the world?
No.
Five.
Five total?
Yeah.
What's the origin of your name?
No, six. It's Ukrainian.
There's only six? Are you kidding me?
Like, I'm not kidding you. So we looked it up once. My brother has two kids now, so it's a different number. But we looked it up. My friend Stefan had this app. And it showed you like rankings or something of last names.
Yeah.
And there was three Halachuks in the world when we looked it up. Me, my brother, and my dad.
Oh, yeah. I don't have that experience. Do you know that the most famous Vishkana is a beautiful woman who plays it's a soap opera villain in India. And do you know about this?
Why would I know about this?
I don't know. Maybe I told you, but yeah. So
I just Googled the name and you're the first.
Yeah, I'm the first one, but there's
like five pictures of you.
Yeah. They're not that
still. You have a Discogs. I'm not seeing this woman actress.
Well, it was pretty bonkers for a while. I would get tagged every day. I forgot I had a Snapchat, and every day I would be like, I get an email that said someone in New Delhi is trying to log into your Snapchat. They were trying to hack the Vishkana.
Why do you have a Snapchat?
I don't remember why I got it. It's
you're like 45.
I've
years
never
old.
Used it. I just signed up the same thing you did. I was like, well, I better get one in case someone takes my name. Anyway, this is.
So she didn't have it. She
no,
didn't already
but
have
I, but,
it. This
but
was
I,
like 2 weeks ago.
I don't remember when. No, this phenomenon. I don't know. I was getting tagged on Twitter as being Vishkana on the soap opera for like. This happened 4 years ago. It was very popular and very strange. And
that's like Jonah got hit up by Jonah Falcon. Jonah Falco from Fucked Up.
Who's Jonah Falcon?
he is a adult entertainment industry actor.
That's...
and he wanted to do a collab.
Oh my God. That's okay. Well, I didn't expect this to end this way. All right. So people can find Fucked Up on the internet and on Post and maybe on Hive. If we can go out on a song from this yet to be released record called One Day, Mike, what would you pick? Yeah. What would you pick for us and why would you pick it?
Well, I like track three.
You like track three? You don't know the names of your own songs? You like the song Huge New Her?
Yeah.
Did I allude to this song? I think I did.
Well, this is the humming one. There's humming on it.
There's humming on it. And what does that expression mean? Huge New Her?
It doesn't. Well, there was a laundromat near my house that closed down.
Hmm.
And they had all their signage left up on the stuck to the window, the inside of the window.
Yeah.
And at some point they were advertising huge new washers, and some of the letters fell off. And so for like a year it said huge new her. and it was captivating. And I was at a cafe trying to write some lyrics like right next door. And it had a nice ring to it. Huge new her.
Yes, you sing about a washing machine in the song, The Laundromat, yeah. And you actually invoke huge new her. Okay, well, that's, see, positive. It's a comedy.
It's about like Greek ladies,
yeah,
from thousands of years ago,
yeah,
congregating to wash their garments,
mm-hmm,
at this. And I turned it into this place where they would congregate and there was like an oracle fixture there. And so it became this thing where these ladies would all go to this washer zone, which I guess in those times would have been like a rock or something.
Sure.
And they would get their fortunes told by the oracle.
Yeah. So you actually invoke, am I saying this right? A peplos? That's the actual name of the garment, right?
Yeah. I have no idea how to pronounce it.
Okay. Well,
but yeah,
it's Greek to you.
It's a cooler thing in a lyric to say than toga.
Yeah, so yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, all right. Yeah, this is a great new song from a wonderful new Fucked Up record. The record is One Day. This is Huge New Her by Fucked Up. Mike, always a pleasure to have you on this show. And to
record. Can't wait to redo this and to in a couple days and just try to do it a bit better.
I was just going to say, and to record a single interview and not redo it. It's always it's always nice to do that with you, Mike. Thank you so much once again. And I'll see you soon on tour, I gather. And best of luck.
Well, you'll see me in a couple of days on Zoom.
Yeah, when we pretend to redo this interview. But for some reason, I forget to hit record. Anyway, nice to talk to you again, Mike. And best of luck in the future. And thanks again.
Yeah, we'll do it again one day for sure.
Hey, Damien, how's it going?
Doing good. It's good to finally talk to you, I guess now on the record. We've been talking off the record for a hot minute, but it's good to finally connect with you now on the record.
It is nice to have you back on the show after a considerable time not being on the show. It's really lovely to have you back on the show, and it's a momentous occasion. I want to begin, before we get into this great new Fucked Up record and your great new songs on it. Where in the world are you today, Damien?
I'm in my basement, which is where I spend most of my time these days. And it's where I kind of record the podcast. And I just got a microphone and Jonah came over from the band and helped me set it up. And I'm going to start doing vocals down here too. So I'm really like a broken little boy living in the basement now.
There is this movement. I subscribe to it a little bit of not leaving your house as much as we used to. I don't know if it's That's just how I'm living anyway. You're saying that's where you're heading?
I've been there, you know, and it's like been a, it's like a fear of mine, to be honest, because it's my Nana, my grandmother, was agoraphobic and one of the kind of like original pioneers, I guess, of someone who has that diagnosis.
Yeah.
And she ran a, like a support group for women in Montreal, and it was very, extremely proud of what she was able to do, kind of, you know, taking, you know, ownership of her life with it. But it's always been a fear of mine, you know, and it's that I'm going to be that person, but I do have that tendency. And I think the only thing that really gets me out of it is having kids and my poor fucking kids, because sometimes they have to deal with the fact that I have these anxiety type freakouts when we're out places and new places. But, so I've always had that tendency. So yeah, I took to that aspect of whatever we've all went through, pretty naturally, to be honest. And that was something that I didn't struggle with.
I do relate to what you're saying, and I do worry about my own kids because I'm very adamant that they wear masks and be careful and all that stuff. And thus far, we've been really fortunate. We haven't, as I'm speaking to you anyway, we haven't gotten anything really bad. And we're staying up to date on all the stuff. But I do think my daughter in particular would be like, I can't wait for this to be over. I'm like, yes, because other kids at school aren't wearing the masks, and other kids, when she goes over to their houses, aren't wearing the masks. So yeah, I relate to what you're saying, and I don't know where, I'm not agoraphobic. You're not. Where are you and I, as outgoing music people, I don't think we're agoraphobic. We're just adapting to a changed landscape. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, but I think in my natural, you know, like I don't go to shows anymore. I think it's why I can do the podcast that I do, is because I've kind of dropped out. And so I don't have any, whatever, quote unquote, ownership over punk rock anymore. So I'm able to separate myself enough from it to kind of like look at everyone's punk rock as being valid as punk rock. But that's because I don't go out anymore. Like I'm not involved in the local scene. I think if I was, I'd be much more adamant about DIY hardcore being the prevailing form of punk rock, or the only valid form of punk rock. But at this point in my life, I don't go out. I don't go to shows. Like occasionally when a friend's band comes to town, but there's bands I want to see all the time, and I'll have plans to go and see the show. And then I just can't do it.
I see.
Sometimes it feels like there's chains on me, you know, like I remember one night,
man.
I didn't mean to cut you off there, but like, really, I feel like I'm opening up.
Please do.
That's why I hate. I know. I just feel like there's a chains on you where you can't leave the house, you know, in a way. Like I remember going to a show, not going to the show, and just feeling, because I couldn't get out the door. Like I just physically, after dealing with, you know, going out to the kids with the to school, dropping off at school, picking them up from school, making dinner, you know, like luckily Lauren and I split the time, but I think that night she was out or had a friend or something, or anyway, I was just so exhausted that I just was like, I can't do this. As much as I want to be there and experience this thing, I can't. But you know, that's the, I guess, the benefit of the podcast ultimately.
Listen, I want to tell you, you're not alone. I can at least tell you from firsthand experience, you're not alone. I don't go to shows anymore. I try to stay home as much as I can. The thing about doing the work that your podcast, Turn Out a Punk, and the show that I do is you're around. You're at least in the house and around, I think, is one rationale for it. It is time consuming and you're busy with it. I know that from my own experience. I'm sure you're very busy with it and thinking about it and booking guests and editing it. It's all very time consuming, but I'm here. And what I wanted to follow up with you about, because I'm wrestling with this myself. Mercedes, in their latest iteration, came through Edmonton in October, and they did three nights. And I went to see them. Coincidentally, that same week, Daniel Romano's Outfit were here, and I went to see them. Those are the first shows that I have attended in a long, long time. And I don't know, you and I are roughly about the same age. Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a lot going on with you psychologically, personally. When you say there's chains on you, like that's a whole other level. Cause I feel that, and I attribute it to the pandemic, I gather you're not attributing it just to that, but it must be. Is it a factor though?
Well, I think when I'm at home, I just want to be at home 100%. And in fact, like I've been to shows, you know, and I do go to shows. Like I make it sound like I never go to a show, but I have been to shows post pandemic.
Yeah,
not many, but you know, most of the shows I've been to is when I've traveled for stuff. And I think, you know, because that's where I associate going to shows with not being at home, because that's for the last 10 years because of having young kids, babies.
Yeah.
So when I've been at home, I've been at home. And you know, trying to, you know what it's like. You gotta be home to help, to be there.
Yep. Absolutely.
And it got to a point where the only time I was experiencing shows was when I was on the road. Now my kids are a little bit older and Lauren and I have a little more independence again as individuals and people, so we can go and do stuff. But, you know, I feel more comfortable going to shows. Like the first show I went to post pandemic, like there is a post pandemic, but I mean, in the kind of like thawing that happened a couple years ago, the first time. Yeah. Was I flew out to the Dinosaur Jr. summer camp event that they had and saw Negative Approach and Dinosaur Jr. play. And it was the most incredible experience of my life. Like, I just was like in like tears. Like, oh. I don't want to, I'm not exaggerating, but like, you know, and I wasn't like sobbing, but at the same time, like there were just tears of like, I never thought I'd get to do this again. And I can only imagine how you felt, because you and me are, well, music's your life, right?
Yeah, and shows have meant a lot to me. Obviously, maybe it's not obvious to everyone listening, but yeah, I have talked about this on the show. Like, it was routine for me. If I could negotiate the family stuff and everything was taken care of, it wasn't out of the question for me to attend 2, 3, 4 shows a week. And it went down to, we moved to another place, and it took me a while to get out. And then so we moved, just so you know, Damien, like at the end of December 2019. So I had a couple months to attend stuff. And then there was this pandemic. And what I think is going on with me is I got used to not going to the shows. At first it was hard. And then I just was like, well, I guess none of us are able to go. So what am I? You know, and also there was nothing to miss in Ontario. Like, that was my biggest fear. Oh, everything's going to happen in Toronto or Guelph and I'm not going to be there and that's going to be hard. But, you know, I've seen a lot of stuff. It'll be fine. And then when everyone couldn't do anything, I felt like, okay, I started to feel weird when everyone got to go to stuff again. And I was maintaining the stance of not doing it. And I think I've just gotten mostly used to it. It was really nice to see the Sadies again. It was great to see Daniel Romano's outfit. I hope to see, you guys are coming to Edmonton. I will be there, but I also am learning to live without certain things. I'm sacrificing things because of this collective state we're in. And I want to protect my family from serious illness. And I don't want to be a burden to them if I get a serious illness, you know? So that's where I'm coming from, if that makes any sense to you.
I get it. Yeah. I think for me, it was largely, like, I guess, like, punk, specifically, like, you know, the DIY hardcore thing was just, it was almost like a religion, you know, and I bring it up all the time now when I talk about how punk becomes a religion, but it was just so much of who I was and my identity was, like, DIY, specifically hardcore.
Yeah.
And then, you know, fucked up being this band that existed in that world and it felt like it was a short period of time, but it felt like we would always exist in that world. And then to eventually get kind of subsumed up into the larger sort of more mainstreamy, quote unquote, like indie rock world. Like there was just a sort of like loss of identity of like who I was as a person, I guess, like, but not so much because like that I think I kind of was like always, you know, a little bit in touch with, but more a loss of like who I was culturally. You know, if I wasn't going to be a DIY hardcore kid, then what kind of shows would I go to? Like what kind of music would I take in? And it took, you know, a long time for me to kind of be like, well, I guess I could like be in other types of music too, you know? And I think that's the thing about DIY hardcore, though. Like, unless you're like a lifer, and there are definitely lifers and people that put in work to support these scenes, but for the most part, you age out, but there's not necessarily a defined age that happens, but you almost like have to pass on that DIY hardcore zeitgeist to another generation of kids that are going to take it in a different direction, but they're going to be able to thrive off it in the same way you thrived off it. And that same way it got passed down to you by another generation of kids that, you know, aged out or, you know, moved on from it. And that's like what keeps that thing so vibrant and pure. But it was like, yeah, it was like a weird thing to kind of like not be able to hold on to, you know, and like it a lot of, you know, and it's what I'm obsessed with talking about is like the damage that this thing kind of leaves on you, and not to overstate it in its importance, but it is important. Like religion is like my moral code. Once I did kind of like turn my back on the waspy religion I was handed, was turning it into focusing on punk and hardcore. And that my morality came from Ian MacKaye or Propagandhi or Bikini Kill or Fifth Column, or, you know, just like learning about all, like, Noam Chomsky. Like, I got into Noam Chomsky because of Propagandhi.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate this. And it's interesting some of the terminology you've used here, because I asked Mike about some of your songs because I sense a shift in you. Some of the things you were just talking about, I think, are paraphrasing lyrics from the song Nothing's Immortal. And I'm just going to read a couple of the lyrics out so you can tell me what you think of where I'm coming from. And I keep hearing that same old punk song echoing around my head. There's something kind of eerie about it. I hope they'll play it when I'm dead. I've heard that something is better than nothing, but I can't help wondering if this isn't my thing anymore. I asked Mike specifically, like, do you think Damien's talking about aging out of punk? And of course, I think Mike did respond to this, but also was like, that's kind of Damien's thing. That's Damien. That's a question for Damien. And I was like, yes, hopefully I can talk to Damien. And here we are. The other thing that I noticed in the release information, I got the bio for the album. This is a quote from you about writing songs, actually, for the first time on a proper fucked up album since 2014's Glass Boys. The quote from you is, it almost felt like it might be the last time I'd ever get to record vocals for anything. So this sense of fatalism or finality, it's long been a part of your aesthetic, I think, but does it seem more pointed right now, like more urgent to you? And by the way, if I've mischaracterized you in any way here, please let me know. But does it feel more, has it been feeling more urgent to you as you've gotten older and ponder what your role is in DIY, hardcore, punk, music generally?
I think like it's funny because it's almost like specifically Nothing's Immortal. Like that song, I think, is about almost aging out of the idea of having heroes in punk bands.
Oh, I see.
More than it's about aging out of punk bands. Cause like it's very much specific kind of, well, a couple specific kind of incidences and incidents I've heard on the podcast where you like, you believe in these songs, you believe in these lyrics, but at the end of the day, these people are people and they have their failings. Yeah. And you know, and as much as you don't want to do it, you're ultimately going to fail people. Like, I think of the people that have fucked up tattoos. Mm-hmm. Anytime I do something like, in terms of, you know, like, well, if we played this thing or if we gave our song as a sync to this thing, like if someone had a fucking tattoo, would they like how bummed out would they feel? Because, you know, and ultimately it's this weird thing where like you're as an artist, you're not beholden to anyone's expectations, but at the same time, like, there's like a punk thing that you carry with you the whole way through. And there's kind of like a need to be beholden to that, or I don't know, maybe we all feel the need to kind of, not we all, but some of us feel the need to keep people accountable to that in some sort of way. But then you hit a point where you're just like, God, like I can't, you know, I can't help it, but I'm going to wind up failing someone. And just like these people have failed me. And, you know, but like at the end of the day, all I'll do is listen to this kind of music. Like it, as much as I said, like I listen to different types of music. Like I listen to like, like Killed by Death Records and like old hardcore and Japanese Burning Spirits and Brazilian hardcore pretty much exclusively. That's all I listen to these days. And, fine. And that's what I love. And I think, but there is like, definitely you're right about the fatalistic side of things. And I think prior to this record, I think there was like this sort of, I think that's part of having an anxiety disorder is for me, at least, has been manifesting your own worst outcome.
Yeah. You know? Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, sorry, go on.
Well, I was going to say, but also maybe being down on yourself a little bit. I mean, that seems to be a major part of what you're going through.
No, I've always been like this, you know, like I think that's the thing is I've been humbled. I think I've been humbled in the last few years by the reality of the world in a way. But I think like being humbled in like I think the fatalism now, I think in terms of writing the lyrics on that last record, when I was saying that, I didn't mean in like I might die or fucked up might break up. I mean like because we were facing my worst possible outcome. Like the thing that I was scared of, that I was so fatalistic to try and avoid happening, fucking happened, which is the thing that I secretly loved that I pretended to hate getting taken away from me and losing it. And like, you know, there are days where I was like, no one's going to mosh again. Like we were there are days, you know, like there are days we wouldn't, you would cross the street when someone came near you. Right. We were so scared of this.
Of course. Yes. Yes, for a community that is really built on galvanization and gathering, which I would argue, I mean, again, I've talked about this before, like the first time I saw Fucked Up, you happened to be playing next door to the house that we were renting in a basement in Guelph. And
I lost my wedding ring.
Oh, did you? I didn't. So it's, oh my God, did you forever? It's gone. You never got it back?
No, someone found it and I got it back, but the whole show stopped and looked for it at the end.
Oh,
because I went, thank you everyone. And threw my hands out to the audience and add, you know, in love to them. And I was so sweaty that my ring just went.
Oh, I must've missed that. Cause what happened was we had a lot of mutual friends, but I wasn't super familiar with you guys. So I walked over there and I got there late enough that I couldn't get in. I had to be at the top of the stairs watching you guys play. And it was very,
we talked that night too, though, right?
I
swear we talked that night.
Possible. It's possible.
Then I remember seeing you and then knowing you more through the CBC thing afterwards. But I remember like,
yeah, that's possible. I was amazed that these punk kids had done this, because that's how I came to Guelph, like having basement shows. That was an eye-opener for me. But it was very crowded. And all I say, I only illuminate or highlight this because that's what punk was. It's a lot of cramped spaces, a lot of people crowding into Who's Emma or wherever in Toronto. But one of the things
totally ventilated cramped spaces.
But one of the things I took away, and I feel really informed, one of the things that punk taught me is that to be more cognizant of the space you occupy. And I was in an exercise recently. I agreed to be on Mike Watt's show, and he asked me to send him songs that I had recorded or been on. And so I was digging into some post-hardcore music I made a long time ago and reflecting upon what I used to sing about. And one of the lyrics that popped out to me that I thought was interesting for me anyway. How does it go? It's something like, I have made a place for myself in this space I found, and to never look beyond the edge of your skin. I'm directing this anger at something. When you're writing songs, you don't, the yous and the eyes, like it's a narrative device. And I had something in mind when I was writing this, but it was selfishness, I think, of not really knowing what your existence is doing to someone else. You know, I say this to my kids all the time. Like, yeah, like when you eat a granola bar, someone has to deal with that wrapper at some point. You know what I mean? Like everything we do causes a kind of a chain reaction in the world. So I feel in a few, there's the fatalism and the whatever we were talking about. But then I look at these wonderful songs of yours that really provoked a lot of thoughts for me, like Lords of Kensington, which I will be honest with you, and I want you to maybe please summarize where you think the song is coming from first, because I don't want to do a poor job of it. But that got me thinking about what it is we've done in underground culture, what it meant for us to be at Who's Emma in this space, thinking it was really magical for us. But what was that doing to the people who used to use these kinds of spaces? So what I'm getting at is that's what I'm picking up from you, is a sort of recognition of what is my role in this world and how have I impacted it positively or negatively? Is that swimming around for you right now?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. That song was written walking through Kensington Market and looking at, like, do you remember when Nike Presto moved in there?
I mean, I never lived in Toronto. I would go to Who's Emma shows from, we all lived in, okay. A bunch of us came, would always, our crew would come down from Guelph. So yeah. That doesn't sound super familiar to me, but go on. Maybe it'll come to me.
It was this venue popped up called Presto, and it was owned by Nike, and it was sort of like this activation for the Nike Presto shoe, which this is in a very bygone era where this stuff really upset people, which is now seems so quaint because I'm sure everyone would be like, oh, great, a Nike activation.
Wait, what street was that on?
It was on, oh my God,
it's the one that
North South Street.
It's the one that hits Spadina, right?
It's the one that hits College.
Oh, sorry, College. Yeah. It tees at College. Yes, I think I actually went to something there and we were like, what is going on? Or we heard about it. Yes, because there was some murmuring. This is like late 90s, probably.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I remember. Exactly.
Early 2000s, maybe, because I think Fucked Up was already a thing.
I remember some.
Like a band.
Okay. I remember. Yeah, that makes sense for me, too. I remember some kerfuffle about it. Maybe I didn't attend a show there, but I remember people not being happy about it. But please go on. That sounds familiar to me now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the whole kind of community got up in arms. And when I say community, I don't mean necessarily just music community. I mean, like, you know, Kensington Market as a thing, and was like, yeah, get out.
Yes.
And
yes,
chased it out. But this was, you know, in a long line and of these kind of event spaces that would pop up that would bring people from outside of the community into the community. And while at one point you're like, yeah, it's great for local restaurants and certainly bars and things like that. Another thing, this is like also where people buy food,
yeah,
you know, and live and, you know, and sell weed and, mm-hmm, and lived off that stuff and tried to survive and thrive in that kind of world too at that time. And then here, you know, these spaces are, and I mean that in places that I went, in places that changed my life, in places where were for foundational, not necessarily the Presto venue,
yeah,
but a drift skate shop, which I think at some point started doing vice parties. And, you know, I certainly was involved in hosting TV shows with Vice and stuff like that. And I think it's weird because culture and youth are always going to look for spaces for things to happen at.
Yeah.
But the problem is it's always going to be like the lichen or the thin end of the wedge for what's to come. And it's stuff where they're going to chase out the Adrifts. They're going to even chase out the Prestos. And, you know, this is a community that fought forever to resist a Loblaws opening. And then the Loblaws opens. And it's because there's no community left to fight because it's been taken over by different things. But, you know, not to say, but there's no buts. At the same time, there's also a culture that is everyone from Fucked Up to all sorts of different artists that found, you know, space at Who's Emma.
Yeah.
And place at Who's Emma that they couldn't find space and safety. And the Anarchist Free Space after that too, which was a incredible space that, you know, ultimately kind of fell apart. But at the same time, like, you know, and Planet Kensington, and there's just like sort of this tradition of the Greeks before that in Kensington Market, the laundromat venue. Like there's just sort of this tradition of these spaces that so many great musicians and artists and talented people found voice and were able to create great art through these spaces. But at the same time, there is a cost, and I'm not condemning because I'm guilty. I'm questioning because, I think you have to. And then the cannabis stuff too is, you know, I think, you know, being involved once again, making cannabis documentaries at a time, like interviewing Trudeau about weed, like all this sort of bullshit, like it kind of like brought in legalization, which brought in gentrification of cannabis, which brought in fucking Fantinos. I'm sorry if I'm swearing way too much.
No, you can swear. And you're on to something really interesting, because we have been engaged, you in particular, in really cool shit, and it gets commodified. But there's part of us that I think, all, and I'm speaking generally of our sort of milieu, our community, it becomes this bizarre negotiation, because we think the thing we're doing or involved in is really fucking cool, and we wish more people found out about it, but not too many more people, because once that happens, people with money come sniffing around and say, hey, we're a giant car company, why don't we help you do a line of 7 inches? Or, hey, we're a giant shoe company, what if we fund your cool thing so that we can get name recognition for everyone gathered? Because we want to reach your, I'm talking in cold advertising terms right now, capitalistic terms. Like, we want to access your demographic. So what if we brand your event and you can still do all the cool shit and you can afford to do it better? So then as punks, you're like, well, they're fuck. What if we just use their money for something good? But the punks you and I admire most have always been like, fuck that. No. So I hear the conflict in you. I appreciate it. I go through it sometimes when I don't have any control over the ads that sometimes show up on this show. I just have agreed to some minor amount of revenue from it. And sometimes I wince because I don't want to be associated with these companies. And I write an email saying, hey, I heard this bullshit. Can we knock it off? And they say, yes, fine. But they, you know, again, this is the good negotiation. They've want to work with me because I'm doing cool shit. I've agreed. I've made some compromises because I need to justify the work. I'm sure you've been here. Anyway, I'm on a rant. Go ahead.
No, dude, that's why Turnout a Punk doesn't have any ads because, you know, how can I have some of these people on that espouse this? But then the irony being, I'm on Spotify and you can listen to me on your cell phone, which is full of conflict minerals.
Yes.
And we are in this sort of like the 90s, it's so beautiful to look back on that time period because we had this alternative punk economy in our hands, right? Like you could buy your food at the co-op where the punks worked, and then you could go to the punk show and you could buy the punk records. And like, yeah, it's not made with punk petroleum products necessarily, but you know, there was this sort of independent economy where you could kind of be like, okay, we're getting our beans sourced from here and it's all this. But now it's all changed. And I'm not condemning it, but like Turnstiles in a Taco Bell commercial, you know,
it's not, but this is where we're at though. We don't condemn anything because the 90s you're talking about, if any, like you said earlier, someone with a fucked up tattoo, if it were the 90s and someone with a fucked up tattoo heard you did something that they thought was heinous, they're getting that shit lasered off. You know what I'm saying? And now we're just like, well, this is the compromise I make too, because I admire you for not having ads on your show. I did pull my show off Spotify, and for some reason, the listenership went up. I was like, people are like, you know, you're going to lose a chunk. I'm like, I guess, but I can't abide by this company. And yet there's some ads that run on my show that I also can't abide, but it's such, anyway, this is not what
I was going to pull myself from Spotify, and then I'm like, well, fuck, it's bundled into my cable package. I listen to music on Spotify.
I'm
responsible for my own downfall. And like, it also accounts for very little of my listenership. Like when I look at my numbers, it's a negligible amount. It's the second most, but it's still.
Yes. You know. I don't know. And I didn't mean to get into the too inside baseball, but I think people rallied around me because I took it off of there. There's no other explanation for it to go up so much. I mean, so yeah, I think like you, it's hard to condemn people's decisions right now because it's so hard to make any kind of, man, we're giving all of these giant companies this content for free and we don't get anything from them. Like it's just, please Patreon, hey, the odd ad, like up to, it's not, we can't, and musicians have been going through this for longer than you and I. I mean, sorry, you're a musician as well. Like, you know what it's like. Like, you try to make the money you can by doing the art you love, but it's hard. Hard to make a living. So, yeah.
But it's also, you know, it's just where society's at. Like, technology, technology exists to get rid of humanity,
yes.
Dehumanize us,
yes.
Get rid of us, because we are the most expensive thing. And so, just like, you know, Spotify negates the labels, negates necessarily some of the artist stuff, like mm-hmm. negates it just makes it about the commodity, which is the song, and it's worth point whatever of a cent. And that's exactly what it's worth. And, you know, but at the same time, look what that's done to food. Look, restaurants, like families, generations have passed down these restaurants, and then you have a quote unquote ghost kitchen pop up on a food app offering the exact same stuff.
Yeah.
And they deliver. So the restaurant's forced to compete on the food app and lower their prices, but they've got all this overhead and like they can't do it. Like it's just, that's what technology is going to do. It's just going to dehumanize us and turn us into things that can make money or be money. I don't know. It's bleak. Like, this is the fatalism, I guess, is that
this is just it, though. Like, I get accused of this a little bit, too. And I'm like, no, it's the reality. And I know that's hard for us to sound objective when we convey such thoughts, because I get it, too. Like, worrying about mask wearing or the pandemic generally or health and wellness. I mean, yeah, if you start to point out the reality of things, people say you're a drag or a bummer or fatalistic, you know, but you, like, I really admire your songs on One Day because you seem to be in a very reflective mode and I think a very health. I mean, I know you're struggling and I hear the struggle and read the struggle in your lyrics. But like when I look at Broken Little Boys, for example, that's a very incredible array of thoughts. It's very open and candid. And you seem to be in this zone of trying to figure out where you came from and why you are the way you are personally. And then, like I say, when I go through a song like Lords of Kensington, you're thinking about a whole community of people. Like, how did we get here? What did we do together? And the same for Nothing's Immortal. Anyway, I'm all over the place. I just think you seem to be in a really good place. And I assume in this regard, sorry, I don't want to say you're in a happy place, but you seem to be in a very thoughtful place. Let me put it to you that way, like a very self-aware and thoughtful place. And I think it's worth mentioning that for some reason, it's been roughly 9 years since lyrics of yours have appeared on a Fucked Up record. So given what everything I just said, can we talk a little bit about what you suppose has prompted you to contribute lyrics again to a Fucked Up album? Given, like I say, your state of mind.
I was pretty checked out after Glass Boys. Hmm. You know, like Mike and, you know, the process of recording Doze Your Dreams was kind of a nightmare, you know, and I, you know, I've actually like legitimately apologized to Mike for that because he came to me with the record and he's like, okay, let's pick songs. Let's write this record. And I wrote a bunch of lyrics, but I was doing that wrestling TV show. Hmm. I was doing my own thing. And then just when Dose Your Dreams was kind of finished, my mom passed away. And so I was checked out during that whole time, just dealing with my own shit. And then my stepmother passed away.
Yeah. I'm so sorry for your loss, Damien. I'm very sorry to hear that.
Thanks, man. Thank you. It's been long enough now that it's like, obviously it's never not painful, but at this point I'm like, I can be reflective on it and look at where I was at and where put, like, not to be selfish about other people's deaths, of course, but where it did put me, and it made me hard to deal with, you know. And like Mike, you know, carried me as a songwriter, you know. I think he did a lot of unbelievable stuff. Like I was really inspired by Doze Your Dreams, like going in there and recording it, and then definitely inspired by Year of the Horse in terms of what him and Jonah and all the other musicians obviously that played on it too were able to write. And just kind of like, it made me, when I went to this record, like it made me want to just kind of come back to it and really engage with it and write lyrics from a place of, and being in the place where I thought this was going to be the last time I was writing lyrics, not from some sort of like, I'm going to quit the band, you know, or something's going to happen to me, you know, like more from a, no one might want to see us play music again.
Yeah.
You know, and like to be back in that place was, you know, where I'm writing music lyrics from I want to do this, not because I feel like I have to do this, was like a real liberating kind of experience.
Yeah.
I did write one song in between. I wrote a song that's on this Australian only 7-inch about my mom passing away. Mm. And, that was a fucking very raw recording session going in to do that.
I'm not sure.
Shout out to Dylan.
I'm not sure I'm familiar with that song. That was a fucked up song?
Yeah, it's a fucked up song. It's only on it was like an Australian only 7-inch that I think we only did 300 copies of.
Oh.
That has a baby photo of me and my mom on the cover.
Oh, man.
And,
wow.
I really, like, just like a most, I think the cover, I think the B-side actually is the Tragically Hip cover. So, it's not even really a record as so much as just like an open, you know, sob of a release for me.
And what were the two songs, yours and the Hip song that you did?
God.
Sorry.
This shows my lack of knowledge about the Tragically Hip that I'm blanking on the name.
Sorry about that.
No. I was been 100% legitimate about it. Like the Hip are a band that I definitely can appreciate. I like the early records a lot as a younger kid.
Yeah.
But then they were, and I told Gore this, you know, like many times, but they, you know what they was like? It was like, it was like why some people hate Bruce Springsteen that are of a certain age. I get it because the people that liked it were not cool. And I don't mean that not like cool, actually like hip. I mean, like we're like jock assholes.
No, they were assholes. I don't think you were saying they weren't like, you know, like you said, nice, good people, whatever, or discerning people. Yeah, I grew up with them. Most of them are pretty friendly, but then I would go, like, I saw them in a field when I was 14 or 15 or something like that. And
another roadside attraction.
That's correct. Were you at that?
Yeah.
In Markham?
No, but I do remember those things happening.
Yeah.
Because they were like cultural events. Like, they were like, I guess what Grateful Dead shows would have been at a certain point for a generation of kids.
But it was eye-opening because throughout the day, you know, people like Daniel Lanois played and Hot House Flowers and Crash Vegas. That's the one I went to. Midnight Oil. And throughout the day, it was weird being around grown, mostly men, screaming hip, hip, hip at every band. And then and I liked all the other bands. Like, I enjoyed seeing them play. And then, of course, when the Hip comes on, I'm relatively close to the stage, and I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle the mosh pit, if you will. I got that's my first real memory of having anxiety, to be honest with you. I'm like, holy shit, I'm going to die. It's like a stampede. I got to get out of here. And it was weird. The band played well, though, I will say. I remember the band playing well, but anyway, that was the environment. It was brutish, I guess. It didn't feel punk rock. It was just brutish. And, so anyway, all this to say, I didn't mean to go on a tangent about the Hip. I do love them. I love Gord very much. And like you, I was lucky to get to know him a little bit. So, you know, these are the great fortunes in our lives, I think.
Yeah, like he like, you know, and there's that Sloan song, but it's about Consolidated. But like, you know, it's not the band I hate. It's the
fans. Gord took that very personally because
I know
there was a CBC show running at the time going through like songs and some host is this song good or not, and some woman on CBC said something like that, like, oh, it's the thing about the Hip is it's not the band I hate, it's their fans. And I was at the Juno Awards in Winnipeg the year the Hip, it was the same year that this broadcast went out on the air, they were being inducted into whatever, the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, and he quoted her to make fun of her. Cause like, what would that band be without their fans? I mean, just as you're saying, what would Fucked Up be without their fans? Tattoos or not? Like, your fans, you can't choose your fans. And,
no,
and that's a really snooty and snobbish thing to blame someone for. Or I always find it weird when we make fun of one hit wonders. I find it distasteful. That's not the band's fault. I don't think, you know, unless they're brazenly trying to just make a bunch of money. Like, how many one hit wonders, if you dig through their catalog, you're like, wait a minute, there's great records here. Why have we all as a culture decided that this one song is worth making fun of because it was popular? Anyway, this is where my punk and whatever love for culture kind of collide sometimes.
I think it's one of those weird things, though, because, you know, you're right. You can't really control the narrative that exists around your band in regards to, like, you can control the narrative in terms of, like, what you put out there artistically. But in terms of, like, how that's going to be interpreted by people, you don't really have say or control over that. And I find that very true with Gordon. As much as he, like, you know, hated that line.
Yeah.
Even though it's about Consolidated, like, he straight up, Chris Murphy straight up says, like, something Consolidated. And, like, I've asked him,
if I drink concentrated OJ, can I think Consolidated is okay? It was a very ironic diss at snobbery in music. Like, I think, but also I forget, Chris has gone on the record talking about this, but the Hip or Not, to your point, the Hip were not even mentioned. I don't think that he had them in mind. Like, it just got ascribed to them. I think because of that CBC show, frankly.
Yeah. 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 And I think at the same time, because also Gord and the Tragically Hip and what they represent, and I only really ever met Gord. I've only ever met Gord.
Yes.
Or I only met Gord.
Yeah.
But he did not in any way embody what the kids that I didn't like that liked that band in school.
100% the opposite. 100% the opposite.
Exactly. Yeah. He was not. And it's weird because I think in Canada, in the Canadian music industry, it happens a lot more than it does in America, where you kind of get subsumed into being a band of a certain type at a certain point, you know? And, like, I mean, like, bands that become huge, where it's like, oh, you're just taken up as being like a rock band now.
I have come to recognize that band as being a bit more advanced than they get credit for. I also will say that I know that we can have some cynicism when a popular entity gloms on to a cooler, less popular entity, and then you start to wrestle with, do we just think they're cool because they're unpopular? Like, do we get our pom-poms out because we are rallying behind a thing that is subversive? All I'm getting at is a true measure of a band to me, when they're at a profile and a success level of the Hip, one true measure of where they come from for real is who they ask to open for them and who they get to play their festivals. You mentioned another roadside attraction. The next year, I believe, was, to me, what a remarkable challenge to that fan base we're talking about. Eric's Trip, the Inbreds. I forget who else was on that year. The second time I saw the Hip, Change of Heart was opening up, which were a pretty obscure but important band to them, at Maple Leaf Gardens, using their platform, I think, the way Fucked Up has tried to do too, by the way, and other bands who feel like, I want to give back to my community by also turning the music fans in my audience onto really cool music. Yes, there's going to be some tourists in the audience, but Gord had that. Like, anything they ever curated, it was pretty remarkable who they got to open with. You guys, you collaborated with him in Fucked Up. Like, he had an ear for what was good. And I don't think it was opportunistic in any regard. I think he just, honestly, I know him as a music fan. He was an advocate for shit he thought was interesting and good. And sorry, I've gone on a ramble, but he's someone I think about a lot. For someone I didn't know well, for a heroic figure who's been with me for most of my life and the kindness he's shown me over the years, personally, I just think about him a lot. So sorry for going on and on about this, but no, I think you're also, by the time this record ends with Roar, you're also, I think, like I mentioned earlier, you're reflective and stock-taking. There's real love in that song, Roar. And there's real love, I think, in all the songs of yours on this record in particular. I know that I'm generalizing, but do you feel like you're mostly coming from a place of love and celebration and gratitude for the most part?
Oh, yeah. Like, I would say almost all the songs are about things I genuinely love. You know, like, I love Kensington Market.
Yeah.
You know, I love my children. Like, Broken Little Boys is about having trauma and realizing you don't want to pass it on to your kids. Yeah. But then also realizing that society's
it's everywhere. Yeah, every Everything is designed to, in your words, if I may paraphrase, break little boys. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, and no one hears you when it's happening. And it's just, yeah, so that's like, that's about loving my kids and not wanting them to be like me or dealing with the shit that I deal with, or just being bad people to the people around them, you know, like just trying to raise good people. So that's love. There's songs about Lauren, my wife, and, you know, having to be married to a person like me, and how much love and just gratitude I have for her, for putting up with everything. And like, there'd be no me and fucked up without her. I would have quit a long time ago. Like, holy God, she has kept me in this band over the years.
No, I feel that in these songs. And like, I think you've conveyed that love and gratitude. Certainly I can hear you singing to Lauren in that last song on the album Roar. But I want to commend you. Like, I just have been really blown away by your lyrics. By the time of Broken Little Boys, where you get to this really fascinating part that I think delves into your religious background, frankly, the world was shaped by broken little boys, and on the seventh day the Lord heard us pray, Father, give us some self-restraint. But God was corrupt and the whole world is fucked, and a question struck, is God a broken boy? Which you answer, Damien. God's just a broken little boy, and now I offer with regret, and it's meant with all due respect, the world was messed up by these broken little boys. I'm just telling you, man, I found that really fascinating and a really interesting turn from your family, certainly like pondering what it means to be a father in this world and to be a parent in this world with sons, because I have a son. It just hit me. And then to go to this root of like maybe the origin story that most people who are religious, I should say, subscribe to is broken, flawed. I mean, I think that's kind of where you're coming from, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was built like, it's just, I don't know, like the Nicole Panter who managed the Germs, mm-hmm. she's a brilliant, brilliant person. Yeah. And when she was on the podcast, she talked about how sometimes punk is people with trauma passing on their trauma to the next generation or to the next person to pass on that trauma to someone else.
Yeah.
And it's just, when you think about that in terms of human history and looking at this incredibly horrific human history that, you know, people exploit for entertainment constantly, there's just this trauma that's passed on from one generation to another, and then it's inflicted on the people around them. And, you know, like you read this book, like, and I've read the Bible when I was a kid, you know, and I have not reread it. I should probably reread it now, but I did read it as a kid, and like, it's a problematic book.
Yes.
You know,
yes, of course. I've heard about this. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think people have talked about this before. I don't think I'm the first to come to this realization, but if this is my moral code, like this is why punk was so important to me, is because it gave me a chance to have some sort of moral code, but not subscribing to this one that was being given to me by, you know, like the minister I remember seeing one time give this incredibly homophobic speech.
Yeah.
And just like unabashedly, and he was a super nice guy otherwise.
Yeah.
But here he is saying this most hateful shit I've ever heard. And my mom was a flight attendant. Like, I grew up around gay people, like, and queer people. And, you know, it was not something that I found threatening at all. And hear him in a position of power pass it on to kids that might not have that same sort of luck and benefit of having exposure to these people in real terms. Like, how can we not help but pass it on to the next people around us when the authority figures that we worship are giving us this shit?
I appreciate that. And I totally appreciate where you're coming from. I probably should follow up on something you just said. My mom was a flight attendant. I grew up around gay people. What does
I know
that,
that's problematic.
What, I didn't understand what that, what does that mean even? I don't know.
I meant that in the sense that there were a lot of gay people involved in being flight attendants then.
Oh, like, I didn't know that. Is that true? Oh, I did not know that. Okay.
No, and I don't mean to be, cause it is a stereotype. So I don't mean to contribute to that stereotype.
I thought,
but
maybe,
at the same time,
that she was working for a certain airline that I hadn't heard about before.
No, I'm sorry. I should have maybe clarified. But it is kind of a stereotype in terms of a job that, you know, that
maybe in that era in particular,
Okay. I mean, specifically, and there were definitely non-gay male flight attendants too. Just, I don't mean to say that every male flight attendant was gay at that time, but certainly a lot of gay men in my life, you know, that my mom was coworkers with and friends with. And, you know, it wasn't something that was new to me. And my dad, you know, like my dad had gay friends too. So it was like, I just meant to say that in the sense that it wasn't something that was threatening to me. And so I was able to just completely resist this, you know, speech as bullshit.
And yes.
I'm sure there's people around me that didn't have that luck and benefit of being exposed to people that weren't necessarily straight, quote unquote, people in this church.
Well, again, I appreciate your perspective on this and other things that you've brought to the fore on this record. For what it's worth, it's good to have you back writing songs.
I appreciate that.
In the
Thank
context
you.
Of Fucked Up. And I really, as I've conveyed to the others on this episode already, I really love this record. It's got some things like I Think I Might Be Weird is a real left turn for me, as I've discussed. And there's some other just full on beautiful songs. I just, congrats. It's great to have you back and those sorts of things. So now I don't want to spill too many beans about the future, but this 24-hour one-day concept is intriguing to me. Your colleague Mike often comes up with these kinds of concepts. Do you have a sense, different kinds of concepts, I should say. Do you have a sense yet of where Fucked Up, even though you and Sandy, Miranda, have both sort of indicated like this could have been the last one. Both of you have conveyed this to me and in public already. Do you have a sense of what's next for Fucked Up? Anything you can say about what you hope to accomplish in the near future?
Yeah, like I want to reiterate that I think this time this could be the last one felt like that early on in the songwriting kind of process for me. Mm-hmm. Because for me, I spent like 24 hours working on each song in terms of lyrics and vocals. And, you know, so I was writing these songs, some of them in the beginning of the pandemic. And at that point, it felt like this might be the last time I write, you know, and going in the studio and demoing stuff, like this might be the last time I get to sing any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas at this point, like, I feel like Mike, you know, with Jonah obviously there too, he's in one of the most creative, brilliant periods of any songwriter to kind of come out of punk. And I'm someone who's obsessed with this stuff. So the fact that I get to be kind of like yelling over the shit he's writing, I'm along for whatever he's got planned. Yeah. And I'm going to, you know, write myself. So I think we're going to have another record that's going to be kind of like a reflection of this record.
Oh, cool.
That's going to be, we're working on it now, and all the themes and things like that are going to be finding kind of an answer to themselves in the next record. And I'm excited about that. And, you know, I've already started kind of like working on certain songs, and it's cool to have a sense that a song doesn't have to be the end of its life, and that the song can kind of have a second life in a different body.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where the record's at now. I'm already working on the follow-ups for some stuff and, you know, and things I'm like, oh, shit, I wish I had said this, or I wish I kind of expressed this thing last time and clarified it. So I get to go back and do an edit.
Well, that's the thing about one day that we always tell ourselves, like if a day is going badly, there's always another one. And maybe that kind of philosophy applies to you. You made one record. I mean, it does. It does apply to bands, too. You make one record, you celebrate aspects of it, but you have regrets. You fix them on the next one. And so in the one day format, if you keep following it in any regard, or if this exercise taught you anything, all of you, I'm guessing it's that, things are what they are. And the next time you do it, it might be better because you've learned something from that one day, right?
I think every time we've done an LP, it's been almost like a completely different approach, you know? And I think Glass Boys writing lyrics for that, like there was this sort of fatalism, but like a complete different sort of way, where I remember writing lyrics for that being like, you know, this might be the last thing I ever write, you know, like I could, something terrible could happen and I could never write another song, you know, or before that, David Comes to Life, we were writing to a theme. Mm-hmm. Before that, with Chemistry, we were kind of writing to a theme.
Yeah.
And in Hidden World, it was just such an exciting period to be in the studio, being able to do an LP.
Yeah.
They all weirdly also felt like they could be the last one for different reasons. But, you know, this time it felt, you know, it was like kind of like strangely liberating in it.
Well, like you said, you've got Mike who seems to have an endless well of ideas. So, and Jonah and everybody, Josh, everybody in the band. So, as you know, I'm a big fan and it's lovely to see you all making music and doing stuff, including touring. I know, like I alluded to, there's touring coming up. On that note, Damien, if people want to learn more about you and your podcast or anything else, where would you like to direct them?
I'm on, like at Left for Damien on those terrible social media things that we shouldn't be promoting, but we're now committed to for life.
It seems that way, yes.
But, you can also find me on podcast platforms that are also ruining us.
Yes.
So,
yep.
I Turned Out a Punk is the podcast I do. And, I appreciate your support, man, for this band. You've always been there and it really means a lot to have that.
Oh, well, I thank you, Damien. It's been a long relationship in a way, going back a long time. So I'm happy to be a peripheral part or a helpful part if I can be. So thanks for the kind words. I asked the others to pick songs to go out on, but I want to go to you to do that now as well. I think, if everything works out the way I think it is, you're the last interview on this mega fucked up episode. So if there's a song from one day that you'd like us to go out on, can you pick one and tell us why it comes to mind?
Let's go out on Broken Little Boys, because I guess that's the song we, I think, talked about the most. And it's a song that originally was about my brother and about being a sibling. And then I kind of wrote the lyrics and I still had time and I was like, you know what? These lyrics are not it. So I rewrote it as the last song on the record and went and redid the vocals. And, unfortunately my brother got robbed of his tribute, but you know, he's a broken little boy like me. So he's in there.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll send this out to Tristan. Is that who we're sending it out to basically at this point?
Yeah, let's send out to Tristan, sure. My long-suffering brother, my one of the many people that has to suffer through dealing with me in his life.
Brand new music from Fucked Up from their excellent new record, One Day. This is Broken Little Boys. Damien, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope we talk again sometime soon.
Anytime. Maybe you can mend the fence between me and Steve Albini.
Okay, let's take this off the record. I don't know what this is about.
Okay.
Learn it through their lessons. Where to take all it? Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Well, looky what we have here. You made it. You made it all the way to the end of this gargantuan, fucked up episode. Thank you for listening to this episode, and thanks again to Sandy Miranda and Jonah Falco and Mike Halachuk and Damian Abraham from Fucked Up for appearing on this, the 747th episode of Creative Control. Episode 747 mentioned flight attendants. That's a weird coincidence to me, if you know how numbers and jets work. Anyway, yeah, thanks again to everyone from Fucked Up who was able to participate. Josh, I'll get you next time. On this, the 747th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, which is at least 2 months behind, please visit vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook if you wish. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to support this podcast and all of its endeavors. All of the work that goes into it is really supported by you folks out there who make time to and spend some money, I guess, donating to the Patreon. $6 American or more grants you access to exclusive content. I believe the last time that Fucked Up were on, or second last time, they're on quite a bit these days. Josh and Mike and I talked about some current obsessions, and at some point maybe I'll release more stuff from my Fucked Up interview archives. But there's lots of other stuff too. Plus you get episodes earlier than everybody else. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. So thanks for supporting the show with your dollars. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a lot of work. But I like doing it. So anyway, that's enough out of me. Thank you. Speaking of thanks again to the wonderful Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and order things there on their website. It's blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. And there's links in the podcast description, so if you're interested in any of the things I just said, click on those links. Thanks, as always, to Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you once again for making it all the way to the end of this gargantuan, mega fucked up episode, and for subscribing to this podcast and telling your friends about it. I hope you will check out One Day by Fucked Up. It's amazing. And thanks to Merge Records for all their help with all this stuff. And you, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope you're well, and I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.